Okay. Let me try that again. Thank you all for coming. Whatever.
Yay.
You feel dressed down?
Whatever reason you came, whatever reason you prompted you to come, I'm glad you came. Where do I start? First of all, I'm recording this session. I've got some friends who want to hear what I'm going to say. If you have any questions that you don't want to have recorded or posted on the internet, please tell me. And I'll edit them out before I put this up. But I don't ordinarily tell people this side of myself when I first meet them. But Desiree asked me to speak on this subject, and I'm actually kind of excited about it. But you're all getting to know something about me that I don't ordinarily tell people. And that is that, well, I shouldn't actually go forward yet. Where's my mouse? There. Tried to come up with a good title for this talk. Wasn't exactly sure how to title it. Desiree was kind enough to call it a respectful and gracious walk through Mormonism.
But we don't believe that.
Yeah, I've got some fun and exciting details about Mormonism that your Mormon friends probably aren't going to tell you about. And in keeping with the stargazing theme of this RG, I figured I'd point out that in Mormon theology, the throne of God is close to a star named Kolob, which is the greatest of all the stars in the universe. But I kind of figured that was a little bit too obscure, and we should probably cover a little bit more basic ground before we get to that kind of what Mormons call space doctrine. However, a fun bit of trivia about the name Kolob. Those of you who remember Battlestar Galactica, either from, 30 years ago or from current times, know that Battlestar Galactica's Lords of Kobol originated with Glenn Larson, who created Battlestar Galactica back in the 70s, who is a Mormon. Glenn Larson borrowed a number of Mormon terms when he created Battlestar Galactica, including the Lords of Kobol, including the 12 tribes, including the concept of being lost and separated from the tribes that you call your home. And if I remember correctly from the old 1970s TV show, characters were not married, they were sealed. All of this is Mormonism in a science fiction guise. What I finally decided to do was to simply call the talk A Former Believer Reflects on the History and Beliefs of the Church. So what you're going to get, and I'm going to try to be as respectful as I can to those of you who believe in Mormonism or have family members who believe in Mormonism. Just out of curiosity, is there anyone here who wants to own up to it?
I have family who are.
He told me. Anybody else?
Yeah,
you told me that too. Is there anybody here who's going to argue Mormon doctrine with me? Okay. Why?
It's something I know about.
Okay. It's something that I know something about, too. And one of the things that I've found is that there's a lot of misinformation about what Mormons actually believe, sometimes on the part of Mormons. They don't sometimes know what they believe either. But what I'm going to try to do is give you a little bit of an intro about who I am, followed by a little bit of an overview of who the Mormons are and what they believe. I'm going to try to get through that in about 20 minutes. If you want these slides, I'm going to put them up on the internet so you can just get the whole PowerPoint presentation later.
I wanted you.
Oh, okay. So anyway, it's through this whole period of this presentation, I'm going to try to give you the Mormon story the way the Mormons give it, so that you know who Joseph Smith was, and you know how the church is organized, and what they believe, and what the Book of Mormon is all about, so that there isn't, so we can kind of get that out of the way, so you know where we're going. When I get to part two, which is going to be interesting bits about Mormonism that a lot of times the Mormons don't know, or if they do, they have a different interpretation of things than I do. And I'll also try to be as respectful as I can about that, too. I'll give you their point of view. I'll give you my point of view. You can kind of make up your mind for yourself. These are the things that I know I want to cover in that period. particularly, you know, what we know today about the origins of Mormonism and what we know today about polygamy, where it's been, where it is, and where it's going. There's a lot of other things that we can talk about when we get there, you know, when I get through all of this. And so I'll kind of let you guys decide what else you want to talk about after I get there. There's all kinds of things we can talk about, you know, that temple and family history and Freemasonry and racism and sexism and all kinds of things. But let me get through the first part first, and we can get to that afterwards. I think. No. No, that's me.
Oh.
I just wanted to. Pardon? Almost. I wanted to just give you a couple of minutes of who I am in the interest of full disclosure, so you know what my biases are, so you know where all of this information is coming from. I am, and this is the part that I really don't usually tell people, so this is a bit of a stretch for me, born and raised, my ancestors on all, if you follow all of my ancestral lines back, they all settle in Utah in the 1850s. At a time before railroads, when all of them came either from Europe or from New England, carrying their belongings in hand carts. This means that my family's been in the church for a very long time. I believed in it wholeheartedly when I was young, growing up. Went to church faithfully, did the two-year mission in Germany, which is why I speak fluent German. Got married in the temple, did everything I was supposed to do, and then in my 30s started learning things about the church that they didn't tell me in church, and we'll talk about some of those things later on in the program. I am also, not only am I on the GLAM board as San Fernando Valley delegate and your co-webmaster, one of your two co-webmasters, I'm also on the board of another nonprofit organization called the Ex-Mormon Foundation. Why are you laughing? I am. I really am. I'm.
It just seems like a silly organization.
It actually.
Catholic and an ex-Baptist organization.
We get that question a lot. Why is there an ex-Mormon foundation? When? Yeah. Okay. Yeah, she can understand because she's been there. Yeah. There is a very active Yahoo group called Ex-Mormon. Just, you know, groups.yahoo.com/group/ex-Mormon. Which is extremely active, filled with a lot of people who are sharing a lot of pain. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of pain involved in separating yourself from Mormonism because it is a recovery group. It's exactly a recovery group. And there's another one that you should know. I mean, if you're interested in this, there's a website that's actually called Recovery from Mormonism, but the web address for it is exmormon.org. And it's also filled with the same kind of stuff. People have a lot of separation grief. And a lot of family issues and a lot of who am I and where am I going from here kind of issues when they leave the church. You had a question?
Is that a federally tax-exempt organization?
It's a 503c organization, yeah. So it's headquartered in Oregon, but yeah.
We're
paying for it. Pardon?
We're paying part of it.
No. It's a tax-deductible, I mean, it's a non-profit charitable organization, which means that anything you donate to it is a tax write-off. So no, you're not paying for it. Well, yeah, but the Ex-Mormon Foundation is self-sustaining and it's got a healthy budget and everything. I mean, that's you're not paying for it directly.
Is there such a thing as a Jack Mormon?
Yes, there is.
What's that?
Jack? Okay, an Ex-Mormon is somebody like me who has formally resigned from the church, no longer attends, no longer believes, no longer goes out and does, you know, the missionary stuff. Then on the other end of the spectrum, you've got your true believing. Go to church every week, pay your tithing, do everything you're being asked to do, kind of Mormon. In the middle somewhere is the Mormon who kind of goes to church sometimes, kind of doesn't believe everything, doesn't take the whole thing, just kind of believes in certain things, still believes the church is true, but decides for himself or herself whether he or she is going to drink alcohol, drink coffee, how many of these, you know, requirements you're going to actually, you know, participate in, how often you're going to go to church. These are sometimes people who never go to church for years, but if you ask them, sit them down and ask them, do you believe the church is true, they'll say yes. Mm-hmm. Right? Now, in that same kind of middle gray area, there's also another group of people who don't believe the church is true, but go to church. And I was that for years. The reason why they do that is because I've got family members who are expecting things of me. I've got a wife and kids. They're all expecting me to live this role. And there are more of those than we know how to count, because most of them don't admit to it. They go to church, they fill the role, they do their, you know, their obligations, but they, you know, they don't have that burning testimony in their, you know, in their soul that it's true. So yeah, there's all kinds of Mormons. Jack Mormons happen to have a name. These other kind of Mormons that go and don't believe don't really have a name, you know.
Business Mormons.
Call them whatever you want.
You're
right. I think you're right. Okay. So all of this begins with, all of the Mormon story begins with Joseph Smith. Joseph Smith was born 200 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Utah Mormons had a big kind of jubilee celebration last December, celebrating the fact that it was 200 years since the time of his birth. He was born in Vermont. His family moved shortly after that to New York, and he was one of several children, nine, I think. His father's name was also Joseph Smith, which means that he's actually Joseph Smith Jr. That becomes relevant later on. And when he was 14 years old, according to his own story, his family was not, you know, they weren't, you know, dedicated to one particular denomination. They weren't Catholic or Presbyterian or something. And in the area where they were living, religionists were trying to persuade other people to join their group. And the Smith family was very concerned about which church should be the one for them. Joseph Smith Jr., according to his own story, spent a lot of time reading the Bible trying to make sense out of all of the competing claims. And based on the first chapter of James, which says, if any of you have questions, let him ask of God, who giveth all men liberally and upbraideth not, decided to go into the woods to pray, to be by himself, early in the spring of 1820. At this point, according to his own narrative, he beheld a vision of two personages whose brightness and glory defy all description, which we understand to be God the Father and his Son Jesus Christ, who appeared to Joseph and told him that he was to join none of the existing churches, but that the truth and fullness of the gospel would be revealed to him, and he would be the restorer of true Christianity. He wandered out of the grove at that point, kind of, you know, wow, I've just seen a vision. Claims that he was persecuted because of his belief that he had seen God. So generally tended to keep that news to himself. But in 1823, wondering, hey, look, it's been 3 years, now what? You know, why aren't you talking to me anymore? God sent an angel named Moroni. Moroni appeared to Joseph Smith in his bedroom and said, okay, we're getting ready, we're going to get you, you know, you're going to become a prophet here, but we need a little bit more time to pass. But I'm going to show you, Moroni said, where there are golden plates hidden in a nearby hillside. These plates contain the history of Christian believers who lived in ancient America between up until about 400 AD. That between 1823 and 1827, Moroni visited Joseph Smith on a yearly basis, until in 1827, Joseph was allowed to take the plates home and begin to translate them. Between 1827 and 1830, by the gift and power of God, he was given the ability to translate these ancient records, which is what we now know as the Book of Mormon. So the Book of Mormon claims to be a literal history of, well, we'll get to that in a minute. But it's a literal history of God's dealings with his people in ancient America. I should have just put all these, on here at one time. There, whoops, yeah. So, at the same time in 1830, according to the laws of the state of New York, he organized what he called the Church of Christ. The Church of Christ, I'm going to get to this in a minute, but it moved from New York to Ohio to Missouri to Illinois to Utah. And along the way, they figured out that the Church of Christ was not a copyrightable name. So at some point later on in the 1830s, they changed the name to the Church of the Latter-day Saints so that they had something that was trademarkable. But that didn't work either because the Book of Mormon states very clearly that if the church is not named after Jesus Christ, it's not his church, which is how they landed at the name the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, which is known as the LDS Church for short, LDS being an abbreviation for Latter-day Saints. The term Mormon was really applied to the LDS believers by outsiders. They don't really claim the Mormon moniker for themselves. And in fact, especially recently, the church has asked the press, when they're writing about the church, not to refer to them as the Mormon church, but to refer to them as the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Needless to say, the journalists are kind of like, that's a lot of space to take up when we could just say Mormon. However, between the time that he founded the church in 1830 and his death in 1844, he was regarded as the prophet, seer, and revelator, God's mouthpiece on the earth, prophet in exactly the same way that Isaiah and Elijah and so on were prophets in their day. In 1844, Joseph Smith was imprisoned, and while he was in prison, a mob stormed the jail in Illinois and had their faces painted black, and basically shot him to death in cold blood. He's regarded by Mormons at this point as a martyr. And basically, so basically that's his life story. Question? Very good question. There were, on the inside front cover of the Book of Mormon today, there's a statement by three witnesses and another statement by eight witnesses who claimed to have seen the plates, seen the angel, talked to the angel, seen the plates, turned them, looked at them. They are the only 11 people on this earth who have ever seen the plates. When the Book of Mormon was done being translated, according to Joseph Smith, the angel Moroni came and took the plates back. So they are not available to be seen. Now, taking off my Mormon missionary hat, speaking as an ex-Mormon, there's a lot of reasons to wonder if these plates ever really existed. Yeah. Now, so that's Joseph Smith. Now, now we need to talk about the church that he founded. I should have just put all these on one slide. Dum-da-dum. Okay. So like I say, the church was founded in New York State. According to the laws of New York State, you have to have six people to organize a church legally, so they got six people together, signed a document, and they became a church. Shortly after that, they moved to Kirtland, Ohio, largely because they were having a lot of proselyting success in Ohio, and they set up their headquarters there. Also, shortly after that, they sent missionaries to what was then the frontier of America, a place called Independence, Missouri. And the stated purpose of sending missionaries there was to proselyte to the Indians. So what we had for a number of years in the 1830s was two large communities of Mormons. For a variety of reasons, they got kicked out of both places simultaneously and wound up in a place called Commerce, Illinois, which they renamed Nauvoo. Nauvoo at the time in 1839 was basically a swamp. We built a castle in the swamp, which is quite literally what happened. They took a swamp and they turned it into the City Beautiful, which is Nauvoo, which at the time, at its high, at its peak in 1844, was the second largest city in Illinois next to Chicago. So in 1844, when Joseph Smith died, he wasn't really expecting to die, and he hadn't set up a clear picture of who was going to be his successor. And a whole bunch of people who were left behind were left going, well, okay, now what? And a number of people stood up and said, no, I'm going to lead the church. I'm going to be the second prophet, and I'm going to, follow in Joseph Smith's footsteps. And really a number of groups radiated out from Nauvoo at that point, the largest one being the Utah emigrants who went from Nauvoo to Salt Lake under the leadership of Brigham Young. But there are a number of other groups, smaller groups, who said, no, we're not going to Utah. We're going to, you know, we don't believe that Brigham Young is the rightful leader. The biggest of those remaining groups was led by Joseph Smith's widow, Emma, who decided that her son, Joseph Smith III, should be the successor. Why are you shaking your head at me? I'm sorry. Okay, you're shaking your head. I just want to make sure there's no problem. Okay. And they landed back in Independence, Missouri, and became known as the Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints until a few years ago when they changed their name to the Community of Christ. Another interesting one is the Strangites, who led by a guy named James Strang, who wrote, I'm sure from their point of view, he received as revelation another book of Scripture, and took all of his people to an island in northern Lake Michigan called Beaver Island. My personal favorite is a group called the Hedrickites. A guy named Hedrick obtained legal rights to a plot of land that Joseph Smith had dedicated as the spot on the earth where Jesus Christ would return for his second coming, where a temple was supposed to be built by the saints. The Hedrickites owned that land and refused to give it up. And this causes all of the other Mormon groups a lot of consternation because they know that that temple has to be built before Jesus Christ can return, but the Hedrickites don't want to give it up and don't want to build anything on it either. There are a number of those groups, but you know, my history, my knowledge, what I know most about is the Utah group, so that's kind of, when I talk about Mormons, that's kind of what I mean. So I'm kind of going to go from there. Okay. Mormons settled in Salt Lake Valley in 1847. They were kicked out again out of Nauvoo. And the first handcart pioneers arrived in the Salt Lake Valley on July 24th, 1847, which July 24th is now a big state holiday, rivaling the 4th of July. There's a big, you know, 4th of July as well is good, but I mean there's a big parade that goes through town on the 24th of July, celebrating the arrival of the pioneers in Salt Lake Valley. And what they, you know, what they were left with was basically a big desert that they had to make livable. And basically they ended up colonizing all of that, you know, that big desert area, which they referred to as Deseret, which is a name that comes out of the Book of Mormon. The federal government didn't like that name, made them call it Utah. Otherwise, it would be known as the State of Deseret if they'd had their way. They built the Salt Lake Temple over that several decades period. The Salt Lake Temple is actually a really gorgeous granite building that was built out of rocks that were extracted and carried from nearby Cottonwood Canyon. And that was finally completed in 1893, and in 1896 they became a State of the Union. There's a little bit more involved in all of that, though. Question? Yeah? It was, and I'm sure there's somebody who knows this better than I do, it was Mexico. It very quickly became the Utah Territory. But yeah, it was outside of federal jurisdiction when they first got there. Not that I know of. Not that I know of. It really wasn't very long before the feds took over and then they got legal title from the federal government. And when we talk about polygamy, remind me about that question because that all got taken away from them too. They were basically on their own and they were actually really hoping that they could kind of be their own self-enclosed entity because they really didn't like the United States because the United States kept pushing them out. And largely, a big reason why they didn't like the United States is because the United States didn't like their polygamous practices. I said they were really kind of hoping that they could be outside of the, you know, the scope of American law. David?
Born on water, starting in 1846, 1847, 1848, there's the Mexican-American War.
Yeah.
So it's still, like, controversial who owns that land. In 1848, the United States got California, Texas.
Did they get Utah at the same time?
Yep.
I mean, I know it was very soon after that. Yeah. On that note, the Mormons are very proud of the fact that while they were migrating west, they got asked to form a company to go support the war, which was known as the Mormon Battalion, and which marched from wherever they were to San Diego. And there's now a big, you know, statue in San Diego commemorating the Mormon Battalion. Pardon? Really? I did not know that. Mormons settled a lot of the big desert and the Rocky Mountains. They're responsible for settling Las Vegas, for example. Question?
How did they go 46 years without being able to
do
temple?
That's a very good question. Temple work for the Mormons is a very intensely integral part of their worship. It's not. Going to the temple is not the same thing as what it means in Judaism, for example. Temple work is a separate thing from your weekly worship services. We can talk a little bit more about what all goes on in the temple. I'm going to try to not go too deep into that because Mormons really don't like it when that gets talked about, and I want to try to be respectful. But what they did, first of all, is Salt Lake was not the first temple that was built. There were other smaller ones elsewhere in Utah. But in the meantime, they built a thing called the Endowment House, which is really just, it was really just kind of an adobe structure that was just for the purpose of doing the ceilings and the temple work for the dead. And the Endowment House was there, stood on what is now Temple Square until 1890 when it was raised. Good question. Anyway, this is the Salt Lake Temple, just so, I'm sure you've seen this picture a million times. Now, a little bit of an overview of the Book of Mormon. I want to give you the plot of the Book of Mormon so you don't think the Book of Mormon is about pioneers heading west from Nauvoo. Again, the Book of Mormon was first published in 1830. I'll let you decide whether it was translated or written in 1830. But the basic plot of the Book of Mormon goes like this. Everything in Genesis is absolutely literal. Adam and Eve were real people who incidentally lived in Missouri. No kidding. Adam and Eve, all the first chapters of Genesis happened in Missouri. And then when the flood happened and Noah built his ark in Missouri, he settled, when the waters went away, he settled in Mesopotamia, and everything else in Genesis happens in Mesopotamia from then on. Okay? Yeah. Joseph Smith actually dedicated a spot in Missouri, which he called Adam on Diamond, which is the spot where Adam offered sacrifices to the Lord. So anyway, everything in the book of Genesis is literally true, including the Tower of Babel, the whole story of the Tower of Babel, after which God scattered, confounded the languages and scattered the people. Some of those people that got scattered got sent to the American continent, both of them, where they flourished as a civilization until about 600 BC or thereabouts. And we're not really sure when, but they all died out all at once because they were wicked and unrighteous. At that same time, back in the Holy Land, back in Jerusalem, God appeared to a prophet named Lehi and said, "Don't tell anybody else this, but I'm about to allow all of these, tribes of Israel to get carried away captive into Babylon. I want you and your family to be, to get away from this captivity. So I'm going to have you take your family out into the wilderness where I'm going to teach you how to build a boat, and you're going to sail from here off to the American continent, and this land is going to be your land to live in and prosper." This was in about 600 BC. God led Nephi and his family away from Jerusalem. In 587 BC is when the captivity in Babylon took place, so they had a little bit of, slosh room to get out of there. But Lehi's sons were named Laman, Lemuel, Sam, and Nephi. Sam, I know. Nephi was by far the most righteous of the four sons, and he became the ancestor of the righteous race of Lehi's descendants, known as the Nephites. Laman and Lemuel were the bad guys, and they became the head of the other race, the enemy, the Lamanites. The Nephites and the Lamanites battled each other, tried to convert each other for another 1,000 years until in about 400 AD, all of the Nephites were wiped out. One of the messages of the Book of Mormon is that people, live in righteousness, but after a while they kind of lose their ability to, stick to the laws of God, and then God wipes them out. In this case, God allowed the Lamanites to wipe out the Nephites. shortly before they went. The last of the prophets of the Nephite race compiled his history on golden plates and buried them in a hill. His son Moroni, between 480 and 421 AD, said, gee, I'm not dead yet, maybe I'll add a few extra things, and then buried them back in the hill again, and then showed up in 1823 to tell Joseph Smith, by the way, I buried them in this hill, here's where you can come find them, and the whole story comes full circle. So that's basically that. Anyway, that was a picture of Jesus appearing to the Nephites, and I kind of skipped past it. Shucks. I really am out of time. I had no idea this was going to take so long. There are some other scriptures that Mormons consider sacred. One of them is called the Doctrine and Covenants, or the DNC for short. Those of you who are gynecologists, don't snicker. The DNC, the Doctrine and Covenants, is basically all of the other revelations that Joseph Smith received as a prophet during his, 14 years of leadership of the church. And the Pearl of Great Price is kind of a series of other things that Joseph Smith translated during his lifetime. The most interesting one is the Book of Abraham, which Joseph Smith claimed to be written on papyrus scrolls by Abraham in his own hand. I had wanted to talk a little bit about the Articles of Faith. I'm kind of out of time, though. I'm not sure how much of this I want to get into. Pardon? It's 12:30. I know, but I'm supposed to limit myself to an hour.
No.
All right. But I mean, all the good stuff's in the second half, and I haven't even gotten to the first half yet. Okay. All right. Okay, the article, what, question?
I don't understand why it's a problem to go over an hour.
Well, I'm a stickler for being
fast
on time. Okay. While the church was headquartered in Nauvoo, Illinois, the editor of the Chicago something or other newspaper asked Joseph Smith to basically outline what his church believed. He wrote a letter to that editor whose name was Wentworth, which is why it's called the Wentworth Letter, and included 13 items of basically core Mormon belief. These have since become canonized and are referred to as the Articles of Faith. However, they are a little bit superficial. They don't really tell the whole story. For example, Article of Faith number 1, we believe in God the Father, His Son, Jesus Christ, and the Holy Ghost. All sounds very Christian and normal until you realize that what Mormons mean by God the Father and His Son, Jesus Christ, is very different from what most Christians believe. The DNC states very unambiguously that the Father and the Son are separate beings. They have a body of flesh and bone, as tangible as man's. However, the Holy Ghost is not a being of flesh and bone, only has a body of spirit. What is not elaborated in the DNC, and what is not elaborated in print, but was elaborated by Joseph Smith in one of his last sermons, known as the King Follett Discourse, is that God the Father and His Son Jesus Christ have these mortal bodies because they, like us, came down to an earth, not this one, but another one, lived through mortality, proved to be righteous, and were what is known as being exalted. They were basically made into gods. And the little couplet that Mormons tell each other to kind of summarize this doctrine is that as man is, God once was. As God is, man may become. There is a very real deification of the righteous that goes on in Mormonism. And Mormons are absolutely, it's absolutely part of their doctrine that they will, assuming that they continue righteous and endure to the end and all that kind of stuff, will wind up with, as their reward of salvation, not just being saved in the kingdom of God, but actually to be like God and do what he does for another planet and another universe. So the Articles of Faith are actually really a lot like this. I'm not going to go through every one of the 13 of them, but I'm just going to highlight a few to be frank, I'm going to highlight some of the ones where what they tell you in the Articles of Faith is not really the whole story. We believe that men will be punished for their own sins and not for Adam's transgression. Now, I personally happen to like this because growing up Mormon, I never really understood the concept of original sin. I never really understood why, just because Adam screwed up, I have to pay for it. And in fact, Mormons, what? Okay, so in fact, Mormons don't actually have this concept of original sin. In Mormon belief, if you die before the age of 8, basically, this means God just wanted you to show up on earth long enough to get a body, but you're not, you don't actually have to go through this whole probationary period and be tested. If you die before the age of 8, God knew you were going to die before the age of 8. He just wants you to have a body because everybody needs a body, but you're automatically just guaranteed to go straight to, you know, exaltation in the celestial kingdom. Oh, by the way, Mormons believe in 3 degrees of exaltation in the afterlife. One is called the celestial kingdom, that's where people go to become like God. One is the terrestrial kingdom, which is where people go who aren't quite good enough to be like God, but they're still better than most of the rest of us. And then there's the telestial kingdom, which is the word that Joseph Smith made up, which is for everybody else. It's not hell, it's actually a better form of existence than what we know here. So kind of in a sense, Mormons kind of have this idea of, you know, everybody will be saved in one form or another, but not everybody's going to get, you know, exaltation. Not everybody's going to be able to become like God. So.
Can women be exalted?
Yes. Mormonism has a concept of the Heavenly Mother. There's a Heavenly Father, Heavenly Mother. What the Mormons don't tend to talk about nearly as often is that there are several Heavenly Mothers because Heavenly Father is a polygamist. No kidding. So what happens is you and I have the same Heavenly Father. We don't necessarily have the same Heavenly Mother. Okay? Did that answer the question? Okay. We believe that through the atonement of Christ, all mankind may be saved by obedience to the laws and ordinances of the gospel. Mormons have kind of have a weird sort of love-hate relationship with the concept of grace. Grace is everywhere in the Mormon scriptures, but it means something slightly different than it means to your average evangelical Christian. There is definitely not the idea that we're saved by grace alone. We have to do things, you know, we have to do things to merit grace. However, the Book of Mormon in particular is extremely grace-centric, if you will. But, oh, I'm sorry. There is no salvation by grace alone. There is kind of this concept of universal salvation if you define salvation very loosely. Basically, what it means is that there are two kinds of death. There's a spiritual death and a physical death. There are two kinds of resurrection, a spiritual resurrection and a physical resurrection. What that means is that everybody dies with regard to the body. Everybody's spirit leaves their body. And the resurrection of Jesus Christ, don't ask me how, I don't think the Mormons know how, I certainly don't know how, but the resurrection of Christ makes it possible for everyone to be resurrected, meaning that their spirit will be reunited with their physical body. So in that sense, salvation from physical death is universal. Salvation from spiritual death is defined as separation from God. Okay? Those of us who don't live, you know, the commandments the way God wants us to live, are not going to live with him for it in the eternities. And those of us who do live with him for the eternities are the ones who are on the road to becoming like him in every way.
That's Jewish.
Is it?
Yeah.
Okay. Jews probably don't, do they have the concept of, like, everybody being resurrected with a physical body throughout that whole time?
No.
Okay.
Spirit.
Okay. However, even in the spiritual resurrection sense, everybody except the very, very worst of the apostates gets resurrected into one of these 3 degrees of glory, every one of which is better than the life we know now. So in that sense, everybody's kind of saved too. Again, there's a very real component of keeping the commandments in this whole concept of salvation. You have to be doing everything that you can do in order to earn, you know, all of the rewards that God has in store for you. And as you're probably aware, Mormon commandments include things like abstaining from alcohol, tobacco, and coffee and tea, paying 10% of your income to the church, sharing the gospel with your friends and neighbors. There's a whole long list of these things, doing your family history, doing your genealogy, doing your temple work, all that kind of stuff is all wrapped up in things that you have to do as a Mormon to keep, you know, to earn this kind of salvation. Now, if the idea of earning grace, if you recoil from this idea, I'll tell you a little story about something that happened to me. I had just come back from my mission. I was having a conversation with an evangelical who said, no, look, you can't earn salvation. Salvation is like being on the West Coast and being told you have to swim to Hawaii. Of course you can't do it. Nobody can possibly make it, but God's going to provide this airplane. He's going to fly you there. And I said, well, yeah, but we believe that too, but you have to do something to get on the plane. His point was supposed to be, no, there's nothing you can do to earn salvation. I still don't understand from an evangelical Christian point of view. I mean, you have to at least confess Christ with your mouth. I mean, something's got to happen before you can be saved. And I don't really understand why they don't like that idea. Mormons have the same idea. It's just there's a lot more you have to do to get on the plane. Sure. Okay. Okay. This is another interesting one. I skipped over Article of Faith 4. I can read them all if you want, but it'll take too long. Article of Faith 5. We believe that a man must be called of God by proxy and by the laying on of hands by those who are in authority to preach the gospel and administer the ordinances thereof. A little bit of a tongue twister. What it basically means is your baptism doesn't count. Sorry. Only Mormons have the authority to baptize. God gave them that authority. Any baptism that was not done by the proper authority, meaning, you know, the Mormon priesthood, has to be done over. Which puts the Mormon Church in a bit of a bind because they'd really like to be ecumenical as much as possible. They'd really like to be thought of as another Christian church. They really don't like the idea, at least not at this point in their history, of being thought of as, I'll get to you in a minute, of being thought of as, you know, we are Christians, you're Mormons, you don't count. You know, they don't like that. They want to be included. The problem is that Mormon scripture is extremely clear on this point. As part of the first vision in 1820, God told Joseph Smith that all other churches are wrong, that their creeds are an abomination, and their professors, that is people who profess belief in that religion, are corrupt. God does not mince words. God also told Joseph Smith in 1830 that Mormonism is the only church, well, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, is the only church upon the face of the earth, of the whole earth, with which I, the Lord, am well pleased. This fosters a certain amount of, I don't know, elitism. Mormons have a really hard time being ecumenical and the only true church all at the same time. Yeah, although Mormons are not going to be torching embassies anytime soon. Mormons are a little more, you know, we're okay if you don't want to believe us, but we still are the true church, whether you believe us or not. Question?
If there is no original sin, why is it
baptism? Baptism is a sign of commitment to God. It's a statement that says, I am going to, align myself with the will of God from now on. It is also a forgiveness of sins, but only your sins, right? If you did something in your past, now you've walked up to the missionaries and said, I want to be baptized, and they baptize you, everything you've done prior to that point is forgiven. However, you're not responsible for anything that Adam did or anything that any of your ancestors did. You're only responsible for your own misdeeds, and baptism wipes those clean.
So Mormons aren't baptized
in infancy? No. Baptism occurs at the age of 8. And not before? Yeah, because prior to age 8, you're guaranteed exaltation anyway, so there's no point. Do you have a question?
Yeah.
Okay. All right, moving along. Article of Faith number 6, we believe in the same organization that exists in the primitive church. Basically, Peter, James, and John in the New Testament were Mormons. In Ephesians, Paul talks to the Ephesians a lot about church organization and government. In particular, in this passage, he uses this exact same language about apostles, prophets, pastors, and evangelists. Joseph Smith is basically just quoting from Paul at this point. The church government is organized as follows. There's one guy at the head of the church who is the spokesman for God, referred to as the prophet. Today, that man is Gordon B. Hinckley. He has two counselors who are both considered apostles. Their names are Thomas Monson and, who is the other one today? James E. Faust, I think. Then there's a quorum of 12 apostles. There's a collective council of 12 apostles. This is also a Battlestar Galactica thing, by the way. There's this council of 12 apostles who act as a second governing body for the church. And what happens is, when Gordon B. Hinckley, the current president, dies, his two counselors and the remaining 12 apostles all become one big body. They pick their senior member, the one who has the most seniority in that group, and that person becomes the next prophet. Which is the way it's been in the Utah church, at least, ever since. Now, in the reorganized church, the one in Missouri, that's always gone from father to son until recently. But in the Utah church, it's basically... So when Gordon B. Hinckley,
political.
Well, not... It's a seniority thing, which is why all the Mormon prophets are so old. Because they have to stay in that quorum until they outlive everybody else. Yeah, this is true. When he goes, the next in line is Thomas Monson. After that is Boyd K. Packer. Boyd K. Packer, okay, I'm taking off my Mormon missionary hat now, speaking as an ex-Mormon. Boyd K. Packer is evil. It'll be actually very interesting if he becomes the prophet of the church, because he has said some things that are extremely hateful and extremely just evil. And I'm going to be very... Pardon? According to Boyd K. Packer, there are three main evils in the world that present a danger to the church. Those three main evils in the world are... Pardon? No. Those three main evils are gays, feminists, and so-called... I love this term. So-called intellectuals.
Woohoo!
If only I were gay, I could be all three of them.
And you're no longer a member of the church.
Can you imagine it? Okay, sorry. Question?
So if intellectuals, so-called intellectuals, are evil, that means you keep your mouth shut and do it yourself.
You do. You really do. And in part two of this presentation, I'm going to get to that. But there's a lot of research that has been done in the last 10, 20, 40, 50 years into the origins of the Book of Mormon, the origins of the Book of Abraham, the origins of Joseph Smith's first vision, and a lot of other things, making evidence that, for me, again, I'm speaking as an ex-Mormon now, for me is very persuasive and conclusive that this is all made up. Okay? Anybody who has tried to publish any of this information is summarily executed. Excommunicated.
You're thinking Islam now.
You're right, I am. Summarily excommunicated. And the nice thing about, from the church's point of view, the nice thing about excommunication is that the church doesn't have to say why they excommunicated somebody. And that leaves the believing Mormons with the impression that, well, they must have cheated on their spouse or something. I mean, it couldn't possibly be that the church is not true. It must be because these people did something, in violation of the commandments. But because the church won't say what they excommunicated the people for, the people who are excommunicated can say all day long, well, I published this article in this trade journal about Mormonism, and the church didn't like it, and that's why they exed me. And the church can just kind of sit back and say, we're not talking, And that leaves the believing members able to believe anything they want, and often they do.
The
polygamy thing?
No. But the elder abuse, sexual abuse.
Oh, yes. That's a really good question. I wasn't really planning to talk about that. But, yeah. In Mormonism has its own abuse scandal. It's just not as widely publicized as the Catholic one. There are all kinds of lawsuits going on at any given point in time about some, head of some congregation who was covering up for some other, male leader in the congregation who was abusing some, girl, boy, whatever. And, you know, these kind of lawsuits happen all the time. They generally get, you know, settled out of visibility of the news, but, you know, as an ex-Mormon, I hear about them all the time. I don't have any specific examples to give you, but yeah, there is, I mean, there is a huge abuse scandal going on. Pardon? Yeah, right. I mean, they show up in the news every once in a while if you're paying attention to it. It's not something that I generally, I don't pay close enough attention to it that I could give you a laundry list of all the ones that I know about. I read about them, I go, oops, there's another one, and then I kind of let it go because it's not something I focus on. But yeah, this happens a lot. And the church is really trying on one hand to kind of put a stop to it, because, I mean, they know that under American law they have to report abuse. But on the other hand, there's really kind of this good old boys club that kind of says, well, you know, he's a good Mormon. He wouldn't do something like that. Surely this is a vicious allegation that doesn't carry any weight. And, you know, so it really has to go to court before anybody can settle anything. And it's a long story. Okay. Yeah. This is very true. Later on in the program, I'm going to talk about polygamy, assuming that I get I'm going to get time. Polygamy. I want to talk about how, you know, the Utah Mormons did practice polygamy between, you know, their origins in 1890 something. And I say something because I do know what the dates are, but they're not the dates that the church actually publishes. We'll get to that later. And when I get to that, I'll also talk about what happened to polygamy after the Utah church renounced it. So hold that thought, because, yeah, the whole Hilldale, Colorado City thing, that's a really big, really interesting question. Back to the ecumenism again. Mormon Church has this article of faith that says we believe the Bible, just as long as it's translated correctly, and we believe the Book of Mormon.
The Book of Mormon, though, is translated correctly.
So there's no need for that little conditional clause, exactly.
That means they don't believe the Bible.
Okay. That's a very interesting point. And the Mormons take this to mean a lot of different things. And yet, it really depends on which Mormon you talk to. Believing the Bible as far as it is translated correctly can mean a lot of things, one of which is, you know, we generally stick to the King James Version. If you've got some other version that translates something a little differently, we're going to be a little suspicious of that. We also, the other thing that it means is that Joseph Smith spent a lot of the early part of the 1830s, revising, he called it translation, it's really kind of a revision of significant parts of the Bible. He rewrote a big chunk of Genesis, which he called the Book of Moses. He rewrote a big chunk of Matthew, which he called, you know, Joseph Smith's Matthew. I know. It's not a very creative name, is it? Castle Anthrax. I know, it's not a very good name, is it? Anyway, so there's that. The Mormons are never quite sure, though, whether to take the King James Version or the Joseph Smith Version, because the Joseph Smith Version has absolutely no historical, you know, antecedent. There's no doctrinal support for any of Joseph Smith's revisions, and the Mormons are really kind of like, well, do we trust this or not? I mean, you know, he's a prophet, he can speak for God, but he wasn't really translating the original document, the original Hebrew manuscript, so what do we make of this? And the Utah Church has decided to take the Joseph Smith translation and relegate it to footnotes. These are interesting, read them if you want to. The Church of Christ, the Community of Christ in Missouri, has chosen to take Joseph Smith's translation of the Bible and call it the inspired version, and that's the Bible that they use in their worship meetings, which is odd because they're the ones that take the Book of Mormon with a grain of salt and treat it as kind of an allegory. So go figure. But it does, it's true. This language, the way it's written, does give Mormons kind of an escape clause if they find something in the Bible that they don't like. But by and large, Mormons believe themselves to be the latter-day manifestation of the church that Christ originally intended to found, right? He founded the church. According to Mormons, Jesus founded a church when he was alive, put Peter in charge of it. Over time, that church got, you know, corrupted, and it changed everything, and everything's different from the way it is in the Bible. So God had to restore original Christianity, which he did through Joseph Smith. And Mormons believe, and it says this very unambiguously in the Bible, in the Book of Mormon, that parts of the Bible have been removed over the course of that 2,000-year period. So Mormons tend to think of the Book of Mormon as being more reliable than the Bible. However, this is not to say that they completely chuck the Bible out on its ear, because the Bible is still, you know, still the Word of God, but we just are not quite sure how much of it to, you know, how far to take it. So this is a statement from Joseph Smith that pretty much summarizes everything as far as how the Book of Mormon is regarded. Joseph Smith told his followers that the Book of Mormon is the most correct of any book on earth, and the keystone of our religion, and a man will get nearer to God by abiding by its precepts than by any other book. Really, it is, you know, the keystone of Mormonism. And if the Book of Mormon falls, you know, somebody discovers that the Book of Mormon is simply not what it claims to be, all of Mormonism falls too. Hint, that's why I'm an ex-Mormon. Okay. Mormons believe in being law-abiding citizens, unless they don't want to be. We believe in being subject to kings, presidents, rulers, yada, yada, yada. But when we talk about polygamy in a few minutes, remind me about this statement, because really they believe in being law-abiding citizens until God's law supersedes man's law. I'm now done with kind of the overview of what Mormons believe. I've left out some things. There's some, you know, family history and temple work and stuff that I haven't talked about, and garments and whatnot, but is there anybody have any questions about this from kind of a Mormon believing point of view? Linda? Absolutely. I don't. The question was, do Mormon men bring their wives into heaven? I promised that I wouldn't get too much into detail about what goes on in the temple, but in the temple, everybody's given basically a code name that will be used to call them forth from the grave, to resurrect them. And you are going to be called forth from the grave by your priesthood authority, who knows your name. In the case of men, that's their, you know, there's this kind of this chain that goes from, you know, the Mormon man to his, you know, ecclesiastical leader, to the bishop, to the stake president, all the way up to the prophet, right? And the prophet has this same kind of chain of authority going back to Joseph Smith. And so everybody's going to get called forth from the grave by their, you know, their new name. Women get called forth by their husbands. So what happens, you go into the temple, you get your new name. The men get a new name, the women get a new name. When they get married, the wife has to tell the husband what her new name is, but it doesn't go the other way. So I know my ex-wife's new name. She doesn't know mine. She's never known mine. Unless I happen to tell you here, and then it'll go on the internet and everybody will know. David. If in the 19th century she was basically, you know, if you didn't marry, that's it. You're just, you know, you're just condemned. Now,
screwed for being not screwed.
Basically, yeah. Now, in the present day church, unmarried women are prompt, you know, because they can't. In those days, there was no excuse for not being married, because men could be married to as many women as they wanted to be and could afford. Now that everybody's got to have one partner, it's not quite as, the availability of marriage is not quite as open to women the way it used to be. So women who are, and this also applies to men, I mean, if you're not married, you simply don't get the highest degree of the celestial kingdom. You cannot be exalted without being married. But, yeah, well, okay. Well, if Linda, if we get to it by the end of this presentation, I'll tell you some things about gay politics, the Mormon involvement in like Prop 22 and so forth. Gays and lesbians simply don't factor into Mormon theology at all, and Mormons just kind of wish that they'd go away. You know, did I answer your question? Did I finish?
No.
Okay, so in the present day, you're basically promised that if you're an unmarried woman and you join the church and you never get married because nobody ever asks you, you are promised that that this is no fault of your own, and in the hereafter you will be assigned to someone. You know, so there'll be some man who's already married to three or four wives, and if he wants more, he'll get you, right? Because you didn't get married in this life, you'll get assigned to him, and thereby, because it was no fault of your own, you'll be, you know, granted all of the blessings of exaltation. So that's, it's kind of an evolution of that doctrine. I'm losing track of who was next. Why don't you go first?
The Torah is very clear that no one can survive setting eyes on God. How did Joseph Smith
God the Father and God the Son?
Really good question. Well, yeah.
That's all right.
Okay, the question is, how did Joseph Smith withstand being able to witness the glory of God? There is a statement in the Doctrine and Covenants that also says no man can see the glory of the Father and live, unless he has the Melchizedek. Mormon men are there's two families of priesthood in Mormonism, called the priesthood of Aaron, the servant of Moses, the brother of Moses, and the priesthood of Melchizedek, the one from Genesis. And the Melchizedek priesthood is the higher priesthood. It's the one that supposedly Jesus and Peter, James, and John and everybody had. And the Doctrine and Covenants says that the Melchizedek, if you hold that priesthood, you're basically protected from seeing God. So, in other words, nobody can see the face of God the Father and live unless he holds that Melchizedek priesthood. It's kind of a shield against the glory of God.
Like you're seeing him in a mirror.
Yeah. Now, there's so many questions. Now, here's the interesting question. Joseph Smith saw God in 1820, but he didn't get the Melchizedek priesthood until 1828. Go figure that. Mormons do not have an answer for that one. Okay, David.
What about underwear? Should we know anything about
that? Talk to me afterwards.
Yeah.
Question was about temple garments. I really can't talk about that publicly, but I'll talk to you about it later. David Fennig.
A friend of mine went on a Mormon mission for 3 years.
That's basically it. There are some other missions. Yeah, it's most missionaries that go out for proselyting missions like that one. There are other kinds of missions. There are, giving aid to homeless and family history missions and some other things that you can get called on to do. But by and large, especially the people that are our age that go on missions, they're generally going out to knock on doors and talk to people and try to convert them. The other missions that are, like service missions, those are generally reserved for older people that, are retired and want to go. Okay, Alan.
Yeah, who is Joseph Smith's PR agent, and can we get his phone number to do that?
Joseph Smith was very charismatic. Joseph Smith was about 6 feet tall, was very muscular, very well built, and simply had a gift, a charismatic gift. And I don't mean charismatic in the religious sense. I mean, he was just a very personable kind of guy, and he attracted people to him. And I say that both as a Mormon, or as a believing Mormon and as an ex-Mormon, he really was a very charming fellow. Now, in recent years, the church has in fact hired a PR firm, and the PR, meaning in the last 30, 40 years, to do all of their public service announcements and their advertising and deciding what their logo is going to look like and their website and all that kind of stuff is all done by a PR firm. But, in the days of Joseph Smith, he attracted people to him just because he was a really likable guy. Tell me your name again. I should know your name.
Tom,
thank you.
Coordinating that, reconciling that with family forever.
Yeah.
You are going to be with your family forever.
Okay, yeah.
Enoch,
right.
Also become exalted.
Okay, really good question. Mormons don't have an answer for that. I do. For the recording, the question was, okay, so what happens if you get exalted and your son gets exalted? Both of you become like God. You both go off to populate your own universes. How does that work if the families are supposed to be together forever? In the 1800s, so today Mormons believe that, and this is one of their big selling points when they go out on missionaries to proselyte families, is they tell them, look, you're married, you love each other, your family loves each other, you're going to be together forever because we have the authority to seal you together as a family unit, right? This sealing concept permeates Mormon thought. We're going to seal your entire family together so you will live forever as a complete family unit because you love each other so much. And we do this by the authority of, the temple and the Melchizedek priesthood and such. But you are going to become like God. Your children are going to become like God. They're going to go off in their own separate space. And Mormons are kind of, you know, they kind of shrug their shoulders and throw up their hands and go, I don't understand it, but I will understand it later when it becomes important, because I just don't understand it now. You know, when I'm dead, after the, in the hereafter, it'll all kind of make sense. This is the problem that you're seeing arises from the fact that these doctrines evolved over time. And in the 1800s, what the Mormons now call sealing families together for eternity is a concept that started in 1894. But for the first 50 years of the church's existence, you were not sealed to your family members. You were sealed to your priesthood authority, who was sealed to his priesthood authority, going all the way back to Joseph Smith, who in turn was sealed to Adam. Okay, and the goal was for you to be sealed to your, you know, parents, kind of, sort of, but your parents were not necessarily your biological father. Your sealing kind of went back, you were sealed to someone who was sealed to someone who was sealed to someone who was sealed to Joseph Smith. And in 1894, that all changed when the then president of the church, Wilford Woodruff, said, okay, instead of you sealing yourself to somebody that you're not related to, from now on we're going to seal you to your real parents. And that's when the genealogy and family history kick in the church got started. Suddenly Mormons were expected to research their families so that they knew who they were supposed to be sealed to and who they were supposed to seal their ancestors to. But then they were left with this realization that, well, wait a minute, if we're going to seal these guys together as family units, how are we going to deal with this question of them being exalted all together? And nobody's really answered, in 100 years, nobody's answered that question. The Mormons just don't know. No, it's not like that. However, Mormons do believe that God can travel instantaneously and is not bound by the speed of light, but which is odd because he has a body of flesh and bone. How does that work? I don't know. Ron?
Is there more Q&A? Is this all the rest of the Q&A, or is there more?
There's another Q&A. After I get...
Go on.
Oh, go on. Okay. Okay. Yeah, this is Q&A part one. Okay. Okay. Where'd my mouse go? What was wrong with my mouse? I don't know.
God of the Mormons doesn't want you to go any further.
Maybe so. There we go. Okay. The first interesting bit is the first vision. The first vision, again, is kind of the whole foundation of Mormonism, because God appeared to Joseph Smith and told. Now realize, everything that I say from here on is me speaking as an ex-Mormon. All right? And largely, the stuff that I'm about to tell you, your Mormon believing friends probably don't know this stuff. And if they want to know, have them talk to me, I'll have them read stuff. But because there's a lot of research that's been done on this, which doesn't get talked about in church, and your Mormon believing friends just don't know this stuff, by and large. And I didn't either until I decided to read up more than what I was getting in church. Yeah, shame on me for being a so-called intellectual. I got what I deserved. I got kicked out of the church, and now I'm bound for... Anyway, so the first vision is an interesting kind of, there are several accounts of the first vision that were written during Joseph Smith's lifetime, and if you line them up chronologically and read them in the order that they were written, there is a bit of an evolution that seems to have taken place in the telling of this story. In the first version of the first vision, Joseph Smith does not see God the Father and his Son, Jesus Christ. The first thing that he sees is an angel who is identified as Nephi. In later revisions, that becomes many angels, and in later revisions, it becomes God, and in the very last revision, it becomes God the Father and his Son, Jesus Christ, as two personages. Now, the thing to realize about this is that in that same, you know, time frame, Joseph Smith's understanding of his theology was evolving too, to the point where by the time he starts talking about two gods appearing to him in the forest, he's also beginning to tell people that there are multiple gods in the universe and that we all can become like God, and he's getting this, interestingly enough, from his study of Kabbalah. And another thing that happens with the first vision narratives is that they change in time. In the first editions of the first vision, the first encounter that he has with divine messengers happens in 1823. And that whole bit about, I was troubled, these different religionists were trying to convert us and we didn't know what to do or where to go, and so I went into, I was reading the Bible to figure this out. In the canonized version of the first vision, that all happens in 1820. In the original version of the first vision, it happens in 1823. Researchers have tried to find evidence of this, you know, this conversion, all these religionists coming to town and trying to convert people, and the people who've done the research have pointed this in 1824. So it seems very likely that Joseph Smith was actually telling the story of a real, outdoor conversion episode, you know, come to Jesus meeting, that probably happened in 1824. He's telling the story originally. Oh, thank you. Originally, he tells the story and saying, well, you know, I kind of remember this when I was about 17, and I went in the woods to pray, and I saw an angel. And as he tells the story more and more often, now he realizes, gee, I need to put God in here somewhere. So he backs up the story a few years and says, well, I saw God in 1820, and then I saw the angel in 1823. And in, like I say, in later versions of the story, Nephi becomes Moroni, and the story becomes a little more polished and a little different. But it really does sound to me, and again, I'm speaking for myself, as if this was a tale that grew in the telling. If any of you have read, you know, The Hobbit, J.R.R. Tolkien says that about The Hobbit. He said, I didn't really plan it. It just came out this way. So that's my point of view, is that this whole first vision thing was made up. And Joseph Smith talks in his narrative, in the canonized version of the narrative, that he was persecuted for his beliefs, that he told people that he'd seen a vision, he was persecuted, he was, you know, basically called names. There simply is no historical record of any such thing ever having happened. And the question is raised, well, you know, if you were so badly persecuted, why didn't anybody publish it in the newspaper? Why didn't anybody say anything in court? Why isn't there any kind of a record in the parish records or something of any of this kind of persecution going on? No mention whatsoever. Mormons are going to respond to what I've just said by saying, okay, there are some differences, but when you tell a story several times, you don't tend to focus on all of the same details, which is true. I mean, if I told you about my trip to Europe 2 years ago, I would probably, you know, tell you about this was, you know, this story would be a little different from that one because I'm remembering and focusing on different things. You got to decide for yourself whether the differences in these different first vision narratives are significant enough that you're willing to say, look, it's all made up, which is what I do, or say, they're just a little bit, you know, they're just a little bit different because he was remembering different things. Now, quite frankly, it could be all kinds of things. Frankly, for me, the thing that seals the deal is that in the canonized version, which was written in 1838, God tells him not to join any other church because they're all false. But we have historical records that prove that he joined the Methodists in 1826.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? I want some believing Mormon to explain that one. Actually, they have. They say, well, you know, he was courting his wife at the time, and he just wanted to impress her. But according to the canonized version of the first vision, he was explicitly told, join none of them, including the Methodists. Okay, so that's item number one. That's the first vision. It gets much more interesting when we start talking about... we've done that. It gets much more interesting when we start talking about the Book of Mormon. Now, it might be interesting for me to talk about the Book of Abraham first, because the Book of Abraham is actually a lot more concrete. The story of the Book of Abraham goes like this. In the mid-1830s, a guy named Michael Chandler received as an inheritance from his father a number of Egyptian mummies. Chandler had no idea what to do with these mummies. You know, his father was off in Egypt as an archaeologist, had these mummies that he'd, you know, dug up from the tomb, and then died and left them to his son in his will. Michael's going, I don't know what to do with these. I mean, what would you do if somebody landed, dumped a bunch of mummies in your lap? Well, what he did is he took them on a kind of a traveling road show, took them around, you know, let people come look at them, pay 50 cents to come see them. Whatever, yeah, something. And but he was getting kind of tired of that, too, and wanted to go back to his real life. And somebody suggested, why don't you go over to Kirtland and Joseph Smith will buy these because he likes old stuff and he has this gift of being able to translate ancient records. So Joseph Smith winds up with these mummies, which were purchased for him by his adherents, by the way, who said, hey, you've got to have these mummies. I mean, this is just great stuff. And so they raised a bunch of money and bought the mummies. So Joseph Smith is now looking at these mummies going, what am I supposed to do with these? Everybody believes that I can translate ancient records. So he opens up the coffin, and he looks at, finds these papyrus scrolls on the inside of the buried with the mummies, and tells people that these Egyptian, what is that? Tells people that these papyrus scrolls were written by Abraham. We're talking the Abraham, you know, of Genesis, you know, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, that Abraham. Written by him in his own hand when he was being held captive in Egypt, which is why these things are written in Egyptian. Bear in mind that the Rosetta Stone and the ability to translate Egyptian was basically happening at about the same time, but Joseph Smith figures nobody's going to catch me if I just make this up as I go. So he publishes what is now known as the Book of Abraham and says, and he describes in English a narrative that basically follows the story of Abraham from Genesis with some creative additions. And then the papyrus fragments are lost. At the time that Joseph Smith dies, they're just lost somewhere in the move from Nauvoo to Utah, and nobody quite knows where they went. And so the church has, you know, spent the next 100 years publishing the Book of Abraham and figuring nobody's going to know, you know, who's going to... Well, in 1967, a museum in New York had been holding on to these things all this time. Somehow they made their way to New York. I think there was they went from Nauvoo to Chicago to New York. And in 1967, somebody who knew Mormonism and knew Egyptology recognized, put two and two together, and said to the Mormon church, listen, do you want these? Because I found they're here in this, you know, back in this back room in the museum in New York. And the church took them and did a lot of studying and research and basically concluded that these papyrus fragments were not the Book of Abraham, were not the writings of Abraham, but were in fact funeral texts that were very common and are dated at about 400 BC. So now we have, so now we have the Book of Abraham, which is considered to be proof that Joseph Smith has a gift to translate, sitting right next door to the original papyrus fragments from which he translated, which we know exactly what they say, and they have nothing to do with Abraham at all. And the Mormons are now stuck because, well, how do we, you know, continue to advance this theory that Joseph Smith knew how to translate ancient records? And they've tried all kinds of things. Well, those fragments are different from the fragments that Abraham came from. Well, there's all kinds of reasons why that doesn't wash, and I can go into that in more detail if you want to. But basically, the Mormons have a really big sticking point here with the Book of Abraham. The Book of Mormon is a little bit more problematic, I mean, because you can't prove how the Book of Mormon came into existence because we don't have those original golden plates anymore. And Mormons are really very enamored by the Book of Mormon because it's so complicated, and it's, you know, it's got a very intricate plot, it's got a very, you know, and it's very self-contained. You know, when the Book of Mormon says that something happened in this chapter and refers to it over here, it's all very, you know, neat. And it's got certain textual elements that make it seem Hebraic, and it's got, there's certain reasons why people believe that this really is an ancient document translated into modern English. There are lots of reasons, however, internal and external, why the Book of Mormon doesn't match up with what we know about ancient America. And the next three slides are going to talk about that. The Book of Mormon, remember, was published in 1830. In 1930, one of the senior leaders of the church, in a body known as the Presidents of 70, in case you care, by the name of Brigham H. Roberts, was publicly one of the best-known defenders of the Book of Mormon as an ancient document. Privately, he was asking questions, largely because people were asking him questions. What about this? What about that? And he was a scientist by education, and before he became a church leader, he was a scientist, and so he was well trained in asking questions like, well, how does this match together? He's trying very hard. He's basically being very desperately trying to support the Book of Mormon as an authentic ancient history of ancient America, but there's just too many pieces that are just not lining up. So he writes a document which is intended to be private. Nobody's supposed to read this. This is really intended for his own use. and he circulated among the apostles, among the quorum of apostles, and said, look, here's my problems with the Book of Mormon. You got to help me solve these problems because people are going to ask me questions and I need to have answers. That document stayed in the vault until 1985 when it was basically squirreled away out of the vault and made its way into publication as The Studies of the Book of Mormon by B.H. Roberts, fascinating book, in which Roberts points out, among other things, that by 1930, 100 years after the publication of the Book of Mormon, a lot of things that appear in the Book of Mormon simply don't line up with what we know about ancient America. But, according to B.H. Roberts, what we know about ancient America is also very different from what we thought we knew about ancient America in 1830. Okay, so there's this divergence between, you know, here's 1830, and here's what we think we know about Native Americans, and all of this stuff is in the Book of Mormon. Now we're in 1930. There's a big disparity between what we thought we knew in 1830 and what we now know in 1930. But all of that gap, that disparity, is all, you know, laid out in the Book of Mormon. There are things in the Book of Mormon that simply don't line up anymore. One of the most common examples that comes to mind is the use of horses. The Native Americans had horses in 1830. It was commonly assumed that they just had them because they'd always been there. By 1930, we knew that horses were introduced into North America when the Europeans arrived in North America. So how in the world did the Nephites and the Lamanites fight their battles on horseback? And not only that, but they were fighting battles on chariots that were drawn by horses. And we now know that, you know, the Central Americans didn't have wheels either. There are other references in the Book of Mormon to anachronisms that simply don't make sense, uses of grains and metals and metallurgy that just don't fit in that time period. What we know now about when people started using iron and when they started using steel don't line up with what, you know, the Nephites were doing. So B.H. Roberts is basically writing this book to say, well, now what do we do? He circulated it around among the apostles at the time, and they all said, we don't know. So his book basically like stayed under wraps until 1985. It's fascinating, really, if you're into this sort of thing, because he's all these things, these issues that he brings up that he knew about in 1930 are still just as relevant today, if not more so. In addition, one thing that I should talk about before I walk away from this slide, B.H. Roberts discovered a book which was published in the 1820s in Joseph Smith's neighborhood by a man named Ethan Smith, who is no relation to Joseph Smith, called A View of the Hebrews, in which, in the View of the Hebrews, Ethan Smith postulates that the Native Americans are all descendants of the lost tribes of Israel, that they all became dark-skinned because they were evil and wicked, which is what the Book of Mormon postulates. We'll get to the racism aspect of Mormonism later. And that they were all wiped out by their righteous, or the righteous half of these, you know, Native Americans were all wiped out by the evil half. All of this is like Book of Mormon, right? I mean, it's all right there. I mean, it's the whole story is retold. There's also a group of people that are convinced that Joseph Smith stole a manuscript from a man named Solomon Spaulding. I'm not even going to go there, but there are some reasons to believe that too. But the bottom line is that B.H. Roberts was able to point to another source that Joseph Smith would have been familiar with, which tells basically the same story. If Joseph Smith did not borrow directly from Ethan Smith, at least those ideas, those memes, were current in his daily life. And it's not really very surprising that he would have borrowed those concepts and put them into his book. Particularly when, if you read the Book of Mormon and you try to find evidence for it, it really doesn't have an antecedent in ancient America, but it does have an antecedent in 1830. So to me, that's all the evidence that I need, that the Book of Mormon is fictional. Yeah, Tom. Oh yeah, Joseph Smith was absolutely convinced that the burial mounds were Nephites, and that's an interesting story too. One time they were on a march, basically. They were on the verge of getting kicked out of Missouri, and so a whole bunch of them went from Ohio to Missouri to try to, you know, support their brethren who were being kicked out. And along the way, they passed by one of these burial mounds, and Joseph Smith said that this was the burial place of a man named Zelph, who was a white Lamanite, Now remember, the Lamanites were cursed with a dark skin. I haven't actually gotten to that part yet, but they were cursed with a dark skin for being evil. That's God's punishment.
This is after the Book of Mormon.
Right, the Book of Mormon was published in 1830. This march to independence is happening in 1835, I think, or 1836 or something. But one of the things I haven't gotten to is the Book of Mormon is very clear that the Lamanites have their dark skin because they rebelled against God. God punished them with a dark skin. Mormonism is also very clear that Africans have a black skin because they're the descendants of Cain, and we'll get to that in a minute too. But yeah, there's this very real racism in Mormonism that they have not apologized for or moved away from. Now, the burial mound, Joseph Smith was claiming this was a man named Zelf who was a white Lamanite, which was a rare, an uncommon occurrence. The reason why this is problematic, we'll get to this if I have time, is that now, today, enough studies have been done showing that Native Americans did not originate in Jerusalem, but they originated in Asia. And so the church is kind of backpedaling from its original stance, which is that everybody in North and South America, their ancestors are described in the Book of Mormon. Now what they're saying is, well, okay, yeah, they came from Asia, but there's some little pocket of Nephite, of Lamanites, still around. We just don't know where they are. And they're probably in Central America somewhere. The problem with this is, and so they've got the whole Book of Mormon story limited to a very small segment of basically, southern Mexico. The reason why that's a problem is that Joseph Smith said, this is a white Lamanite in this burial mound in Missouri. So that whole, which throws that whole theory about the whole Book of Mormon happening in southern Central America. Okay, how do you explain that? And the Mormon apologist's answer is, well, Joseph Smith must have been mistaken. He just must not have known what he was talking about. But then, okay, you're going to go down that slippery slope, So, yeah, does that answer your question? I think that's what you're asking about, right? Well, yeah, the Zelf, the white Lamanite thing. Oh, well, yeah, there's that, too. I mean, the Book of Mormon, it was in the 1820s, it was widely, commonly believed that the Native Americans were, in fact, descendants of the lost 10 tribes of Israel. But there was no evidence for this. Joseph Smith, in my opinion, Joseph Smith wrote the Book of Mormon thinking, I can write this book, nobody will be able to call me on it. And, everybody already believes that the Native Americans were descended from, Israelites anyway. This way we can explain the burial mounds and explain, explain Native American civilization. We can explain, and the Book of Mormon goes into a lot of explanations for, how they started scalping people. The Indian concept of scalping people is right there in the Book of Mormon. Stuff like this. The Book of Mormon kind of serves as an explanation for how all these things got started. Burial mounds are kind of, not directly referenced in the Book of Mormon, but that whole idea that there was a civilization on this continent before, before the Europeans arrived, that's really what the Book of Mormon is trying to address, in my opinion. So moving forward in time a little bit, we then get to the 1950s and 60s where a similar episode happens. Thomas Stewart Ferguson was an archaeologist trained at BYU, very interested in, very much a believer in the church. Do we need to use this room, Jennifer? Okay. Very much a believer in the Book of Mormon, very anxious to go rush down to Central America and find artifacts of Nephites and Lamanites and find artifacts of Nephite civilization. Spent a decade doing research down there, uncovered some very interesting things about ancient American civilization, but didn't find any evidence of Nephites or Lamanites. What? Oh. What time is it now? What time is it now? Oh, God. Okay. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jenna. Okay. Thank you. I had no idea this was going to run so long. Okay. So, Thomas Stewart Ferguson goes down to Central America, spends a decade, doesn't find anything, gets very depressed, and comes home. But while he's down there, he's writing books. He's all excited. Look, we're just taking for granted that these civilizations that we're unearthing are Lamanite civilizations. And look, we found these temples and these, you know, jars and you know, things that show what the Lamanites used to be like. And he's writing these books, and the Mormons are just eating them up, buying these books, writing less, going, wow, now we know more about the Lamanites than we ever did. But he comes back after a decade realizing, these aren't Lamanites. We're never going to find evidence of the Book of Mormon. You know, because what he was looking for was a Christian baptismal font or some kind of evidence that there was Jesus anything in their history. No, completely not. And all the things that are in the Book of Mormon that are considered, you know, that I consider anachronisms, became even more pronounced as anachronisms the more we really learned about what ancient American civilization was like. There's a fascinating book about his life. It's called Search for the Gold Plate. It's a much easier read than the B.H. Roberts book, and it was written by Stan Larson. Also a fascinating read. Kind of a sad one, though, because he gets to the end of his life and goes, what did I do? Now we get to the part that you guys read about in the newspaper yesterday. Jenna pulled me aside yesterday in hospitality and said, what about that? I know Simon Southerton. I know Thomas Murphy. I've met both of them. Thomas Murphy is the chair of anthropology at Edmonds Community College near Seattle. Simon Southerton is a molecular geneticist or molecular biologist with a specialty in genetics or some such thing. He's also the head of a Mormon congregation in Australia.
Not anymore,
he's been excommunicated.
Oh,
again, remember, if you publish anything that doesn't make the church look good, you're out of there.
So both these guys are gone.
Actually, the Thomas Murphy story is an interesting one. Thomas Murphy has not gone to church for a decade, but he wants to hang on to his membership for reasons that only he understands. So he was the first one to get hit with an excommunication threat, and he did a very interesting thing. He went public. He immediately went public, went to the news, you know, the AP, the Associated Press, and said, I'm being harassed for publishing, you know, this statement that says, and again, this is, you know, we know enough now about DNA, we've done enough research and sample studies and stuff to know what anthropologists were speculating about all along. They had speculated that Native Americans came across the Bering Strait. Now we know, because we've got the DNA evidence to back it up. Thomas Murphy is an anthropologist, not a geneticist, but, you know, he knows what he's talking about, and he goes ahead and publishes in an anthropological journey. It's like Anthropology Today or something. He's not actually publishing to, you know, your average reader, but he publishes and says, you know, the Book of Mormon's got nothing to stand on. There's no DNA, there's no, you know, genetic evidence to support the Book of Mormon story about where the Native Americans came from. Thomas Murphy went public as soon as he got this excommunication threat, and the news went wild. And suddenly a bunch of us ex-Mormons started holding vigils, candlelight vigils, out in front of strategic places around the country. I was living in Seattle at the time, and one of those vigils was in front of his home. And I actually went to his home, and we stood outside and held candles on the evening of his disciplinary, they call it a court, basically. You're being put on trial for apostasy, basically. And while we were at his home, you know, it was great. He had, you know, cheese and crackers and wine and things. It was a big party, and while we were there, he got a phone call from his ecclesiastical leader saying, well, Gordon B. Hinckley called me and said to call it off. So Tom Murphy somehow escaped. I mean, you know, he brought the press in and escaped getting excommunicated. He's still not going to church, but at least he's still a member. But yeah, Southerton? Pardon?
Was the wine any good?
Yeah. He throws a great party. Question?
Did you say he had wine?
Yeah. Yes. Tom Murphy is not a believer. He just wants to hang on to his membership he just wants to be able to say I'm a member of the church. I don't know why. I just don't know. But I mean, he knows.
He can.
What? Just because he can, I suppose. I don't know. I can't speak for him. I don't understand that part. But yes, he's not an ardent believer. He doesn't go to church.
Maybe his family, you know.
There's a lot of that.
Go
I mean,
to Christmas. And,
there's a lot of that. I mean, if this presentation were more about me and less about the Mormon Church, I could tell you more about my story. But I stayed in the Mormon Church for years because of family commitment.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of people do that. Question?
Say in the church, does that require the being seen with
eyes? That's a good question. People who are in the church, remember the question about Jack Mormons? I mean, there are people who belong to the church and who are on, you know, the church likes to count its numbers. It likes to say, we have this many members, right? And it, you know, it does that by taking everybody who got baptized, subtracting out everybody who got excommunicated or died, and it doesn't really matter whether you actively participate. It's simply a count of baptisms versus death, right? And but while you're so when you're in that state, you've been baptized, you haven't been excommunicated, you haven't died, you are a member in a sense, but you're not actively participating. You're still a member, as far as the church is concerned. That's the level of membership that Tom Murphy has right now. Now, I kind of did a different thing. I mean, I was a believer until my 30s, and then I said, you know, this, I learned this stuff, and I went, you know, this doesn't make sense to me anymore. And but I kept going for several years because, you know, I was married, I had kids, my parents, everybody's expecting this of me. And it took me a number of years before I stood up and said, screw it, I'm out of here. I'm not doing this anymore. And I paid a price for it. I mean, I left the church, and my marriage fell apart, and, you know, I mean, a whole bunch of things happened to me all at once right then. That's exactly right. They would rather keep you on the membership roll, even if you're not paying tithing. And, in fact, what happens is, of all those people that are listed as members, the church is now counting about 12 million members.
Wow.
More than half of those don't go to church, and of the remainder, more than half of those don't pay tithing. I mean, it's really a small fraction of that 12 million who pay tithing. But yeah, I mean, if you want to be considered a super active Mormon, you need to be paying tithing, you need to be not drinking alcohol, you need to be not drinking coffee, you know, all those kind of things that Mormons do to get your temple recommend, right. To be, another, for those of you who don't know, to be allowed to go into the temple to do, you know, temple ordinances. So yeah, I mean, he's just nominally a member and that's all. But he wants that. He does not want to be excommunicated. He wants to quit before he gets fired, basically, if he's going to leave, which, you know, I admire him for that. I just don't quite understand it. So Tom Murphy and shortly thereafter Simon Southerton published the statement that says, look, the church really can't back up its claim based on genetic evidence because the genetic evidence is very clear that, no, there are no, you know, Israelite, you know, Jerusalem descendants in, you know, in the DNA of Native Americans. The Mormons are going to look at this and say, you haven't sampled every single Native American on the planet. So there still could be some Lamanites out there. And in fact, okay, so here's the thing. I have in front of me the text of the LA Times article from was it Friday? February 16th, which I guess is Thursday, written by William Lobdell, whom I don't know, which is basically summarizing this whole Simon Southerton thing, which, by the way, happened 2 or 3 years ago. I mean, this is not new news. There's really nothing in this article that's new. It must have been a slow news day, and Lobdell figured, I know this story, why not put it in the paper? It's not news. This did not happen yesterday. This happened 2 or 3 years ago that Southerton wrote this book and got excommunicated for it. But basically, and you're welcome to read this. If you want me to pass it around, or you can read it later or whatever. But it's basically just a summary of this whole problem that, you know, the Book of Mormon claims that everybody in North America, well, I mean, the Book of Mormon claims that Israelites came from Jerusalem to North America, to the American continent. It is true that the Book of Mormon doesn't explicitly say that everybody in North and South America was a Lamanite, but that's the way the Book of Mormon has been interpreted until this whole bit with the DNA studies came out. Now that the DNA studies came out, the church is backtracking a little bit and saying, well, probably the Lamanites are just this little community somewhere in southern Central America. So, this came out on February 16th. The very next day, or probably 5 minutes later, the church's own website published a correction, what they call a correction. It's basically disappeared in the media, and we don't agree with it. Quote, oh, it is actually dated February 16th, so they came out with it on the same day. Quote, the Book of Mormon, another testament of Jesus Christ, is exactly what it claims to be, a record of God's dealings with peoples of ancient America and a second witness of the divinity of the Lord Jesus Christ. The strongest witness of the Book of Mormon is to be obtained by living the Christ-centered principles contained in its pages and by praying about its truthfulness. Translation, don't pay attention to any scientific evidence.
Stand behind the curtain.
Don't, exactly.
But no other part of Christianity is scrutinized for veracity. Why should this
Well, interestingly, the interesting, I mean, Christians will commonly point to the fact that the Old Testament points to archaeological, you know, data that is, you know, verifiable,
yeah,
whereas
right.
there's, you know, the cities in the, that are mentioned in the Book of Mormon simply have no correlation to anything. Yeah. Last second paragraph in this press announcement. Recent attacks on the veracity of the Book of Mormon based on DNA evidence are ill considered. Nothing in the Book of Mormon precludes migration into the Americas by peoples of Asiatic origin. In other words, they probably all did come from across the Bering Strait, or most of them did. But we still claim that there's going to be some small pocket of Lamanites out there somewhere. The scientific issues related to DNA, however, are numerous and complex. Those interested in a more detailed analysis of those issues are referred to the resources below, and they quote a bunch of pro-Mormon websites. Now, the pro-Mormons, the Mormon supporters, are basically saying, oh, come on, genetics, you know, you can't trust it. There's an old movie about Charlie Chaplin that starred Robert Downey Jr. from 10 or so years ago, where, you know, he's in court, and it's a paternity suit, and he's all happy. Before he goes to court, he's all happy because the blood tests prove that he's not the baby's father. He gets into court, and the prosecution says, don't pay attention to that, any of that newfangled science about blood tests, because we don't trust it. You know, DNA is the same thing. Come on, people, wake up. But, you know, the Mormons are still kind of hanging on to this idea that the Book of Mormon still could be true. We can't find any evidence of it. We don't have any archaeological proof. All the scientific evidence seems to point away from it. The Mormons are sitting around saying to each other, this is just Satan trying to test me, tempt me and trying to test my faith. All right? This is how the Mormons look at it. We don't need evidence. We simply need to pray and be, you know, faithful to the church and...
Exactly.
But the thing you got to realize is that when you go to a Mormon church service, they're telling each other every single Sunday that this is literally true, and anybody who contradicts it is either lying or deceived by Satan or something. What's interesting to me about the Book of Mormon is that in 1830, it all made perfect sense. It all fit together with what people thought they knew about Native Americans. We didn't need to be playing these kind of games, because in 1830 it all fit. But in the last 175 years, we've learned an awful lot about ancient America that simply doesn't line up. And I could believe that the Book of Mormon, you know, that the whole idea that the Book of Mormon might still be true if we could just find the evidence for it, if only, I could believe that, and I could still be a Mormon today, if only I couldn't point right straight at the common cultural myths about Native Americans in 1830 and say that's the antecedent for the Book of Mormon. To me, it's just way too clear. That the Book of Mormon is a work of 19th century fiction, because, yeah, I can't find ancient American antecedents for what goes on in the Book of Mormon, but I can find 19th century antecedents for those very same statements in the book. To me, it's simply too clear. Again, though, I mean, this is my bias. I'm speaking to you as an ex-Mormon. Your Mormon friends are going to have a very different take on this, but to me, it's really very clear.
So you were punished for intellectual curiosity.
I also quit before I was fired. I did the Book of Mormon. I did the Book of Abraham already, so we've covered that. I probably should have put that first. Now, let's do the polygamy thing. I can't believe that this is running on for so long, but I'm glad you're so interested. I'll try to keep it short. I don't have any slides for this because it's all in my head, but... but... Yeah, but I've done enough reading on this that I know the story pretty well, and I don't think that anything I'm about to say is going to be factually inaccurate, at least not to do. Okay. Me? I've had one.
That's become illegal.
I may have another one, but I'm going to make sure that I do them in sequence. However, remember, that my ancestors, remember, my ancestors were all, you know, early settlers of Utah, and most of my ancestral lines were polygamous. I had one ancestor who had 10 wives at once. You know, growing up in a Mormon home, there was a certain amount of pride in that. Cool, we had a 10-time polygamist in our ancestors. Most of the rest of them were like two or three wives. I mean, they really didn't have a lot more than two or three, but most Mormons in that time period were polygamists. Here's what happened. Joseph Smith founded the church in 1830 and was not immediately into polygamy just yet. He had just recently married his wife, Emma. But as, you know, he began to attract followers and as his popularity grew, I mean, he had, at the time of his death, he was a rock star. At the time of his death, he had 30,000 followers. On two continents, one, a bunch of them in Nauvoo and a bunch of them, interestingly, in England. But he was, I mean, this is not, you know, this, we're not talking about a couple dozen followers. He had a big following. And, you know, whether it went to his head or whether, I don't know, I mean, what exactly went through his mind, we'll never know. Although there have been, sorry? Yeah. There have been a number of interesting psychological studies written on Joseph Smith. I can tell you what those are if you want to read them. But basically, nobody's really quite sure. What we do know, though, is that starting in 1831, remember, found the church in 1830, first polygamous affair is in 1831, he has basically the woman's name is Fanny Alger. She was 16 years old. Emma caught them and got really angry. And I'm sure he was very apologetic, and gee, I'm really sorry, but about a decade later, in the 1840s, he started getting really serious about this idea that Abraham, it was okay for Abraham to have multiple wives, it was okay for David and Solomon to have multiple wives, it was okay for, you know, Israel is named after the grandson of Abraham, whose original name was Jacob, whose name was changed to Israel in by God, and he had he's the father of the 12 tribes of Israel. And he had, you know, 12, well, I'm simplifying, but he had 12 sons, and they all, each of them became a tribe. There's more to it than that. But he had those sons by several different wives at once. I mean, if you go back and read your book of Genesis, there's Israel, the head of the Israelite nation, having multiple wives at once. And God approves. Not only does God approve, but God gives favored status to the son Joseph, who was the son of a second wife. I mean, come on. So Joseph Smith is looking at this and saying, well, I'm here restoring the true religion of God. Why not restore polygamy? You know? And he gets this idea that, you know, this is God's will, in fact, to bring polygamy back in the latter days. And he begins to get married to several wives.
What did Emma do about this?
Emma had no clue. This is what's interesting. Emma had some clue. But, excuse me, Joseph Smith went to great lengths to keep all of this from Emma.
Married meant what? He was the one who married them?
No.
They
became his multiple wives. They became his plural wives. But what's interesting, pardon? Okay, so here's the thing. Joseph Smith was you know, he by this time he was the president of the church.
So
he had a
No.
He by this time he had kind of an inner circle.
Oh, okay.
These were the people who were the apostles who were in that other governing body. You know, he's the president and then there's this quorum of 12 apostles. These were kind of his inner circle and he had sworn them to secrecy, but they had the authority to perform marriages. So they were the ones actually officiating.
Okay.
What's interesting is that in this time period, Joseph Smith was advancing an idea that says that you can be married to somebody else legally, but you don't have the divine authority to be married. We, the church, are the only ones with the authority to marry you, you know, divinely, and, you know, in the eternities, which meant that you're married to her. Are you married? It's not my business, but let's assume that you're married to her. And I decide, I'm Joseph Smith, and I decide, she's really hot. I want her. So you're only married legally. I'm going to marry her spiritually, and she's going to be my wife in the eternities and your wife just on earth.
I'll take her on earth.
Joseph Smith is documented to have married other men's, to married in this sense, basically to have slept with other men's wives.
Oh, but he had slept with them.
That, well, there's a very interesting book written by a guy who used to live in...
He didn't want them in an afterlife. He wanted them right now.
No, the other way around.
Exactly. Well, he wanted both. What he did basically is he went to the daughters and wives of his associates and said, God has told me that you and I need to be unioned. We need to be joined. We need to be sealed together. And this will be in the eternities. You two can stay together for this life. But just to kind of seal the deal, let's make sure that we sleep together once and just kind of make it official. Okay? It's
most of the prophets that we see now, the quote unquote, they do that type of thing.
Well, now which prophets are you talking about?
The Kool-Aid prophets.
Okay, right. The David Koreshes of the world. Yeah. I don't know about that. I'm not going to speak to that.
Okay.
I am going to say that this whole idea of one man married to another man's wife died with Joseph Smith. But there's a very interesting book called In Sacred Loneliness, written by Todd Compton, who used to live in Los Angeles and now lives up in Northern California somewhere, which is a documented history of 33 wives that we're sure we know about. And he talks in there at great length about which ones Joseph Smith probably slept with and which ones he probably didn't. And there's evidence that he at least slept with some of them. It's clear that he slept with Fanny Alger because of what we know about her. But there's other ones that he probably slept with too. Mormons are not going to tell you about that part. In fact, a lot of Mormons are not aware that Joseph Smith had any more wives than just Emma. Which is why this book by Todd Compton is very interesting. Todd also managed to escape being excommunicated, and I don't know how the heck he did that.
So did Emma ever find out? What did she do when she did?
Question is, did Emma ever find out? Emma... Almost. Actually, here's the thing. Remember that Joseph Smith dies in 1844, and there's a succession crisis. The crisis being, who's going to lead these people now? Okay. Most of them went with Brigham Young west and settled in Salt Lake. A significant minority of them went from Nauvoo back to Independence, Missouri. Independence being a little town on the frontier, on the western border of Missouri. Went back to Independence and founded this other reorganized LDS church. That reorganized LDS church was led for a long time by Emma Smith. I mean, Emma Smith was the instigator of that group. And her son, Joseph Smith III, when he became old enough to, function, became the next prophet, right? I mean, Emma was never really the prophet because women can't be prophets, but Joseph Smith III became their second prophet. Joseph Smith III spent his entire life trying to prove that his father had never slept with anyone but his mother. And Joseph Smith III himself would come out to Salt Lake and engage in open debate with the polygamists in Utah, saying, you cannot say that my father ever slept with anybody but Emma. He was very fierce about this. I don't think Emma knew. I mean, or if she knew, she certainly didn't let Joseph Smith III know, because he had no clue. And was very adamant about it. Now, though, I mean, we look back on 175 years of history, and we know, yeah, he did, because we've got all these testimonials and diary entries and all kinds of things written by these women that would say things like, I did this and this with Joseph Smith. It's all right there in black and white. But Joseph Smith III, and probably Emma, too, did not know that. Now, there are stories about Emma, walking in on, they brought this other woman into the home to be a cleaning, to be a servant girl. And she discovers that, this woman is pregnant and throws her down the stairs. And there's stories like that, but it's not really clear to me, at least, what Emma knew and what she didn't know.
Oh, no.
Men have multiple wives. Wives only have one husband. However, the only exception is...
No, you just said these two are married, and you went up and you married
her. Yes, and that's right. Exactly. And what I'm saying is that...
And somebody else will say, I want you, so
not, no, no. That's what I'm, this thing that I was talking about is referred to as polyandry, the one woman with multiple husbands.
Okay.
But first of all, it died when Joseph Smith died. They didn't carry that with them to Utah. And second of all, she only has two choices. One is the civil husband that she married legally, and the spiritual husband that she marries in front of the church. She can't have any more. That's it.
Oh.
Right? She can be married to one person for what we call for time,
uh-huh,
meaning just for this time period that we're on this earth. And she can be married to somebody for eternity, meaning, you know, after death. So she can have up to two, but that's all.
Okay?
But I can have hundreds. And Brigham Young.
There's nothing wrong here.
Yes, that's true.
Now, did she get any choice about which one she spends eternity with?
Women don't get
during the Joseph Smith period, not really, because Joseph Smith was calling all the shots. You know, he'd walk up to somebody and say, "God told me that we're supposed to be together." Very rarely did he get turned down, and there are a couple of interesting stories about him getting spurned, which I could tell you if we wanted to go into that. But okay. But for the most part,
women are vengeful.
For the most part, what Joseph Smith wanted, Joseph Smith got. Okay. Now, remember that this is all done very secretively, and in fact, Joseph Smith during this whole period is making public statements. Polygamy? I don't see any polygamy. I'm not involved in polygamy. He's making these public statements about how, no, we only believe in one, you know, one man, one wife. That's it, right? But you know, secretly, this whole sort of polygamy thing is going on behind the scenes, and a group of former associates of Joseph Smith become disaffected and decide to publish an expose, which they call the Nauvoo Expositor. They published this in 1844. Joseph Smith gets wind of the fact that a former associate has leaked all of his polygamous secrets and, you know, secrets about polygamy, and decides this cannot stand. So he orders the printing press destroyed and orders all of the copies of the Nauvoo Expositor destroyed. Most of them were, but there are some that have survived, and you can order a copy of the Nauvoo Expositor to this day if you want to. And Joseph Smith was imprisoned, not for polygamy, but for, what's the word I'm looking for, interfering with the freedom of the press. That's really what he was jailed for, was interfering with these people's right to publish. The feeling among the local non-Mormons was that he probably was going to get away with this because, for whatever reason, and they decided not to wait for justice to take it, you know, to make its move. They decided we're going to take the law into our own hands, which is why they stormed the jail cell and shot him. Now, again, succession crisis happens. Brigham Young takes most of his people to Utah. The rest of them scatter to elsewhere, Texas and other places, and Beaver Island. In Utah, they arrive in 1847, and they kind of get settled, and they set up, you know, settlements and farms and stuff. And in 1852, they decide, okay, now we're going to go public, because now we're outside of, you know, there's no state government here that can persecute us. We're going to do whatever the hell we want. The federal government gets wind of this and says, well, we can't allow this. Because what the Mormons were thinking in Utah was, there's no law that can stop us. We're going to go public. Well, the feds retaliate by saying, well, good, we're going to make a law that says you can't do this. Unfortunately, they made the law while the Civil War was going on, and the feds just didn't have the time to prosecute this. So the Mormons kind of disregarded it and said, well, screw it, we're going to do whatever we want. So in the 1870s, they did it again. They tightened the feds tightened the screws a little bit and said, you simply cannot be married to more than one person. The Mormons retaliated by saying, well, good, we're just not going to tell you when we do. We're going to get married to one person in court, and all the rest of them we're just going to marry in church and not tell you, and you're going to have no way of knowing. So in the 1880s, the church tightens the screws again and says, the feds tighten the screws again and say, okay, now it's going to be illegal to live together with somebody. If you own two homes, and you've got one woman here and one woman there, and we can prove that you spend an equal amount of time in both homes, you're out of there. And it became known as unlawful cohabitation, and the Mormons decided, well, look, this is what God wants us to be doing, this polygamous thing, and so we're just going to disregard the law. We're above the law. We're going to do whatever the hell we want. And Mormons got jailed by the hundreds and thousands for, you know, it happened so often that they stopped calling it unlawful cohabitation and simply called it UC.
Are there a lot more women in Utah than men?
No. That's actually a very interesting question, because now in today's Mormon church, the Mormons tend to like to say that there were, in an effort to try to justify the whole polygamous thing. It's not true. if you go back and read the census records and you read the, you know, the
right.
you know, if you look at the documentation from that time period, no, there was a fairly equal amount.
Because that's why a lot of the Jews were polygamous. The men died off, and there were these poor women that had nothing to do.
And
their
right.
mother...
Yeah. Right.
Really,
they would take them in,
not as a sexual thing.
Right. And so today's Mormons would love for that to be true, but there's simply no, you know, there's no historical basis for it, so they can't really say it, but they try.
So a lot of men just didn't have wives?
Yeah, although not in my family. I mean, in my family, there were plenty of women to go around. Where they came from, I don't know. So, now, people are getting jailed for unlawful cohabitation. Leaders of the church are in hiding. The church decides to take this to the Supreme Court, because they believe that they have the right to practice their religion any way they want. So they take it to the Supreme Court by sending a guy named Reynolds. Oh, come on, I should know his first name. But a guy named Reynolds got used as a test case. He was in jail. He appealed, went straight to the Supreme Court in a case that's now known as Reynolds versus the United States. Reynolds was found guilty. The Supreme Court decided that, yes, you have the right to believe anything you want, but you don't have the right to practice anything you want on a religious basis. So the church is now basically stuck because they don't have, they went to the Supreme Court, they've got nothing left. But they still said, well, we're going to keep doing whatever, we're going to go to jail because we're, you know, being, sacrificing, you know, our freedom for the beliefs that we hold dear. And so now the feds are going, well, what else can we do? I mean, we've already established that this is illegal behavior. There's no question about it. So they suddenly started saying, all right, here's what we're going to do. We're going to start. One of the problems that they had was that because only Mormons were in Utah, anytime they tried to have a jury trial, the Mormons would all be on the jury and they'd all vote the guy not guilty. So the feds took away from the Mormons their right to vote and their right to serve on juries. That still didn't work. That still didn't stop this whole thing. And so then they said, we're going to confiscate all your property. And it was at that point that Wilford Woodruff, who was the president of the church at the time and who was extremely... more than probably any other Mormon prophet, was extremely centered on the temple and temple worship, was very concerned about the possibility of the Mormon temples becoming somebody else's property. This was just sacrilegious to him, and he couldn't stand it. And so he wrote a document which has since become known as the Manifesto, wrote it in 1890. It was a letter that he wrote without the rest of the apostles knowing that he had written it, because they were out of town at the time. Pardon? A lot of them were in hiding. A lot of them were in Europe. A lot of them were on proselyting missions in Europe. The manifesto says, is basically a statement by Wilford Woodruff that says, yes, we will give in. We will capitulate. We will do whatever the feds want. Please don't take our property. It also says... we don't know about any current... We're not practicing polygamy right now. We don't know what you're talking about. Really, we want to be law-abiding citizens. I have another thing you can read if you're interested. Picks apart the manifesto, sentence by sentence. The entire thing is a tissue of lies. It was a stalling tactic. Wilford Woodruff was stalling. And the reason why he was stalling is that back in the days of Joseph Smith received a revelation which was slightly ambiguously worded, in which Joseph Smith is said to have asked God, when is the second coming going to occur? And God responded, not before your 85th birthday. Joseph Smith didn't get to be 85, so there's no real telling what that meant, but his 85th birthday would have been in 1890. And Wilford Woodruff was convinced that the second coming was imminent and decided that if we can stall... very soon, Jesus will come again, fight all our battles, and we'll be back to where we started, and we'll be back to practicing polygamy the way God wants us to. So the manifesto was a stalling tactic, which the rest of the apostles didn't have any real part of. He sent it to Washington. Washington said, okay, fine, we'll talk to you now. And the modern church likes to say that they stopped practicing polygamy in 1890. The facts of the matter are, the tissue of lies that kept right on practicing it secretly up into the 1900s, and we have documented evidence for this, and I have more books that I can have you read if you'd like to. It did finally die out, though, and what's interesting is that they're still practicing it up right up until the 1900s, right, into the first decade of the 20th century. At the same time, they're going to the feds and saying, hey, look, we'll cooperate. Please don't take our property. And by the way, could we be a state now? And the feds said, all right, fine. As long as you put in your constitution that you will never allow polygamy ever, we'll let you be a state, which is why they didn't become a state until 1896, because they didn't capitulate until 1890, and there were several years of, you know, working out the details. Their constitution still says they cannot be polygamous in any way, shape, or form, or cannot tolerate it or allow it. But they were still doing it. Right after, you know, despite all of this, they were kept right on going. Until Utah wanted to seat senators in the U.S. Congress. At which point somebody in Congress raised a concern and said, we can't seat this guy. I mean, you guys aren't being law-abiding. You guys said you would, you know, stop practicing polygamy, and we've got all this evidence that you're still doing it. Even though they had sent a monogamist to that, you know, had elected a monogamist, the Senate was simply not going to seat him. And so to get to the bottom of it, they had another round of testimony in court, at which point the president at this point is a guy named Joseph F. Smith, who is like the grand nephew of this Joseph Smith, who, in front of a grand jury, under oath, says, I don't know what you're talking about, which is a complete lie. The man lied to Congress. But he realized... Yeah, I know. But what he understands is that God wants us to practice polygamy, and that's the most important thing in his understanding. This is more important. I know. But what Joseph F. Smith finally decides to do is, all right, look, we really have to take this seriously. He issues what's called the Second Manifesto, and from that point forward, the church really does stick to being monogamous. Now, what they do, though, is there's an agreement with the federal government that says anybody who's currently in a polygamous relationship, they can stay that way. You don't have to split those guys up. No more new ones. Okay? And that's pretty much the way it's been until now. However, starting in about 1930, the thing you got to realize is that for 80 years, people have been told that 80, where did I get that number from? 50, 60 years, whatever. But people have been told, this is something God wants. You have to believe it. It's a requirement to enter the celestial kingdom. You absolutely, positively have to be practicing polygamy or else. And now suddenly they're not doing it. And you're leaving a lot of Mormons kind of going, what? You know, now what? For whatever reason, a number of individual Mormons came forward and said, you know, maybe they really believed this, maybe they were opportunists, I don't know, I'm not in a position to say. But they'd stand up and say, the Utah Church, the Salt Lake Church, the one that Joseph F. Smith is in charge of, they have fallen into apostasy by renouncing this whole polygamy thing. God still wants us to practice it. God has called me to be the prophet of this, you know, now, yeah. And so, and a bunch of them actually stepped forward and said, I am the new prophet. I am, and we are going to practice polygamy now forever. And regardless of what the feds do, and we're going to stand up to the feds, even though the Utah Church isn't going to have the backbone, to, you know, because they're in apostasy and we're not. There have been a number of these, and in about 1990, the most recent one was formed in Manti, Utah, by a guy named Jim Harmston, who decided that everything after Brigham Young was a complete, you know, state of apostasy, and he took his followers back to, you know, the days of the 1860s, where blacks were not allowed to hold a priesthood, men had to have multiple wives, all this kind of stuff that Mormons used to believe that they no longer believe, Jim Harmston is now, you know, promoting. And there are a number of these little pockets of polygamous communities in and around Utah that are... The Salt Lake Church does not recognize them. They've all been excommunicated. They're not, according to Salt Lake, they're not Mormons. But they call themselves Mormons. They call themselves, you know, Latter-day Saints. And the press likes to write about them as if they're polygamous Mormons or fundamentalist Mormons. And this causes the Utah Church a great deal of grief because No, they're not Mormons. We excommunicated them. They don't count. But, you know, what's the press going to do? They try to make this distinction. It's kind of hard. So there are polygamists in Utah. They call themselves Mormons. They are not on the records of the Salt Lake Church, but they call themselves Mormons, and they trace their right of authority back to these people who claim to have had visions, like the first vision, saying, God gave me the authority to restructure the church, and so I am now the prophet in this dispensation. And that's where, when you see news stories about, you know, these communities where somebody is being jailed for statutory rape for having sex with a 16-year-old, they really are not Mormons in the sense that the Salt Lake Church thinks of as Mormons, but they're Mormons in that other sense where they believe that they were given the authority by God to continue the whole polygamous thing. In the 1950s, there was, when television was brand new, there's a community on the border of Utah and Arizona called Colorado City, and it's on the border for a very good reason, because when the Utah police come down to that community, they all move over to the Arizona side and say, we're not in Utah. You don't have any jurisdiction here. And when the Arizona police come up to the border and say, they move on. In the 1950s, the feds decided, well, obviously this is our responsibility because we can't get them to stick to one state or the other, so we're going to come in and break them all apart. Well, television crews were there on the scene and filmed them breaking up these homes and tearing these families apart, and you had pictures on television of these little kids crying for their mommies that were being, you know, carried away in buses. And it made the public was very sympathetic to what these polygamists were, you know, what was being taken away from them, contrary to, I think, what the feds were expecting. The feds were expecting, well, we're going to go in there and make them obey the law, damn it. And when the feds realized what kind of a PR backlash they were causing, they kind of said, all right, fine, we're going to stay away from this. We're not going to go there anymore. Let them do whatever they want. And now the only time that you prosecute polygamists is when they, you know, get it on with a 16-year-old girl and violate, you know, statutory rape laws. Every once in a while you'll see that in the news, you know, this person, that person got, you know, arraigned on statutory rape charges, but they don't arraign them. They don't, you know, try them for polygamy per se anymore. That's basically, you know, whatever people want to do in their own bedrooms is their own business. It's kind of the policy that the government has today. So you don't get a lot. So what you get now is a lot of people who believe that Brigham Young was right about polygamy and want to keep doing it, and some of the numbers that I've seen about polygamists who are, you know, affiliated with Mormonism in some way range from 30,000 to 50,000 adults in and around Utah who are in some kind of a polygamous relationship. And every once in a while they show up on, you know, 60 Minutes or something.
Why didn't they just move to another country when the feds went
after? Very good question.
And where does the name Mormon come from?
Two very good questions. They did, in fact, move to different countries. And there is a big community in, I don't speak Spanish, I don't remember, it's Ciudad and something or other down in Mexico. And they also sent a colony up to Cardston, Alberta. Those communities are still very big. The one in Cardston does not practice polygamy anymore. I believe that the one in Mexico still does, and I know people who descend from those communities. The Mexican government and the Canadian government are, you know, they also have laws about this stuff, but they weren't quite as vigorous about enforcing them, and so those kind of flourished for a while. But they're there. But now, I mean, the church is very clear now. I mean, today, if you try to practice polygamy in any form, you're out of there. In fact, if missionaries go into, you know, Africa, any kind of Muslim country, and find somebody who's already in a polygamous relationship, they can't join the church without leaving all but one of the wives behind. You simply can't join the Mormon church today and be polygamous. You can't. I mean, if the missionaries find some African family that's one man, two wives, and they want to join the church, they can't. By the same token, you know, if I'm living with my girlfriend and the missionaries come and want to baptize me, they won't baptize me until we get married. That's another interesting point. I mean, you're not allowed to have sex outside of marriage in Mormonism. Which leads to the whole question about gay marriage, but we'll get to that later. Pardon?
It's not sex.
Gay marriage?
If two men engage in lewd conduct, that's lewd conduct, yes, but it's not sex.
According to Mormons, it definitely is, and it's illegal because marriage is not legal. They're freaked out, though, that it might become legal, because now everything that they've been saying about how you can't have gay sex and you can't have unmarried sex, if gays can become married, what do we do?
Clinton did not have sex with that woman. He didn't.
Depends on your definition of is. Okay. Now, so I think that pretty much covers the whole polygamy discussion. Now, I had written this last night thinking, okay, what if we have some extra time? What else would you guys like to talk about? Obviously, we don't have a lot of extra time, so I don't know whether...
Yes, we do.
I'll keep going until you guys, like, fall over, but...
Are you a bad person if you go to the tanning salon? Is that
the deal? I'll get to that in a minute. The answer to your other question, the name Mormon, is there's a whole bunch of... Mormons like to point out, when they're trying to find reasons to prove that the Book of Mormon has to be divinely written, you know, has to be from God, one of the things they like to point out is that there's a whole bunch of proper names in the Book of Mormon, a lot of them. And they like to say that, look, Shakespeare only made up, you know, 50 common proper names, and the Book of Mormon has several hundred. To me, all that really says is that Joseph Smith had a vivid imagination. Now, in the Book of Mormon was the last prophet before all the Nephites got wiped out. And he compiled all of his records, specifically knowing that in the future, we who live today would want to read what he had to say. Because he was going to testify that Jesus came to visit them and gave them all this, you know, knowledge and organized the church and all that kind of stuff. And that's a whole other thing that I never really got around to talking about. But Jesus showed up, taught the Nephites, and, you know, after his death and resurrection in the old world, came to the new world. And,
so he made up the name Mormon, which really is a composite of more money.
No. You would think so. Actually, there's a really weird quote from Joseph Smith that nobody in the Mormon church or out of it can make any kind of sense of. Joseph Smith was once asked, what does the name Mormon mean? And this is what he said, all right? I'm going to tell you what he said, and then I'm going to tell you I don't understand what he meant by that, and neither does anybody else. He said that the word Mon is either an Egyptian or ancient. I think he said it was Egyptian. I think he said it was an Egyptian word that means good. You know,
right.
Benevolent, and that more was a prefix that means more. And so Mormon was actually a hybrid of an English and an Egyptian root that means more good, better, okay? Why in the world would somebody who's living in ancient America be named after an English language prefix? I don't know. I really don't, unless Joseph was trying to say that more is an Egyptian word that just happens to sound like the English word more. I don't know. It's weird. I don't get it. But that's what he said, and you can make whatever you want.
It's true because I said so.
Basically, yeah.
No problem.
Basically, yeah.
I do that all the time.
Okay. Do you have a question? Okay. So, I can talk about any one of these things or all of them.
Freemasonry. Yeah, Freemasonry.
Wait. So I got Freemasonry. We have votes for anything else? Okay.
What about biracial people? When they
keep okay. All right. I will start at the top. This is according to this thing, I've been talking for 2 hours and 15 minutes.
Okay.
Institutional discrimination. There's one more. Okay. So let's start first of all with blacks. In the 19th century, it was widely believed that, well, I don't know about how widely it was believed, but it was believed, not just within Mormons, that blacks were slaves because they deserved to be slaves because God cursed their ancestral parent, Cain, with a black skin. That was the curse that Cain was inflicted upon Cain for slaying Abel. And Cain's black skin made its way through the sons of Noah by way of one of Noah's sons' wives, who was black. Yeah. Ham, I think. So basically, the slaveholders in America were telling each other that blacks were slaves because God had ordained it. This was God's way of punishing all of the descendants of Cain for what Cain did.
Even though there was no original sin, right?
Well, the Mormons, see, the interesting thing about the Mormons is the Mormons came along and just kind of accepted that idea without really challenging it. and it made its way into Mormon doctrine. But it's kind of a weird, you know, perverted twin sister of the idea that you're not punished for the sins of your ancestors. Because we believe, Mormons believe, that you're not punished for any sins but your own, except in this case.
Okay.
Now, here's how this works. Okay, here's how Mormons justify this. What I told you, here's what I told you. I told you we all live on this earth for, you know, 70, 80 years, and then we go on and we, you know, progress toward godhood. What I didn't tell you is that all of us existed before we were born as conscious spiritual beings. And not only did we exist before we were born as conscious spiritual beings, but we were never really, you know, created. There's never any point in time where we, you know, where we didn't exist and then we did. We are literally eternal in both directions. Okay? At some point in the past, God took all of his spirit children and brought them together in a big, what's called the council in heaven, and said, I have this really great idea. I'm going to send you guys all down to earth. You're all going to get bodies. You're all going to kind of go through life and have to, you know, gain faith and do all these things, you know, show that you're worthy and righteous. And those of you who are really, really good, I'm going to turn you guys into gods. You can be like me. According to, and this is canonized in Mormon scripture, Jesus stood up and said, I like this idea, and I will go and be your sacrifice to make this whole thing happen. You can send me down to earth, and I will be sacrificed, and I will be the one who makes this all, enables all of this, you know, atonement to occur. Satan stood up and said, no, I don't like that plan. I have another plan. And my plan is that we're going to make everybody do the right thing, and we're going to, that way nobody will be lost. You know, everybody will go to earth, come back, everybody will have lived all the commandments perfectly because I will force them to do so. They simply won't have any choice. This is my plan. I like it better because which kind of makes sense. I mean, I don't want to lose anybody. I don't want to lose, these are my friends, you know, and my family. I don't want to lose anybody. For some reason that is not clearly explained, God decided to put it to a vote. Who likes Jesus' idea? Who likes Satan's idea? The vote turned into what is referred to as the war in heaven. The war in heaven there's references to a war in heaven in the book of Revelations at the end of the New Testament. This is what Mormons think that war in heaven was about. And today's Mormons, now I got to give you the history of this so we know how we got to where we are now, but today's Mormons justify this whole dichotomy between you not being punished for anybody else's sins but your own as follows. What they do is they say, some people unambiguously chose to follow Satan, and those people became demons. They never received a physical body. They simply live on this earth as spiritual demons, and they're here to tempt us and lead us astray. Another group of people unambiguously decided to follow Jesus, come to this earth and be, you know, do what we're doing now. Then there was this middle group that kind of stood on the fence and wasn't really going for, were kind of sitting around waiting to see who was going to prevail before they decided where to, you know, throw in their support. And they're referred to as fence sitters, and the idea was that they really weren't valiant in supporting anybody. And the current modern Mormon apology explanation for what's going on is that all the people who were fence sitters were born onto this planet with black skin. And that's the mark that shows that's the mark, that's how you can know that they simply weren't valiant enough in the preexistence to merit holding the priesthood. Okay? That's how you know that they, you know, so that's how you punish them for their own sins, because their sins took place before they were born.
Yeah.
Cool. Okay.
Okay. Tom, question.
God and this heaven that we're referring to the specific heavenly father of the people of earth, or is this a God in a heaven that rules Pennsylvania over all?
There is a statement in the book of Moses that says, many worlds have I created, worlds without number have I created. The first of all men on each world I called Adam, each planet was called Earth. So, yeah, I mean, he's been doing this for a bunch of times, and this is one of many. The question that's not really clear to anybody is whether all those Earths exist simultaneously, or whether he's done one Earth and kind of taken it through to the end, and then done another one and taken it through to the end, and done another Earth and taken it through to the end.
I'm just getting into the man could become like God, you know. I don't know if that all happens at once, or
well, yeah.
When you get your world, it's the same thing going
to
happen.
Yeah, it does. But then you become God to some other people, right? You become God to other spirits, and you have your council in heaven, the whole thing happens all over again, and you bring some of them to Earth, and they get bodies and keep going. I mean, so in theory, this sort of thing is happening all throughout the universe, lots and lots of gods with lots and lots of planets, with lots and lots of spirit beings, spirit children.
The same one.
Yeah, pretty much. There's a Jesus for each one, and, you know, that sort of thing. So I got ahead of myself, but that's how Mormons rationalize the fact that blacks don't hold the priesthood because it's their own fault for not being valiant in the pre-existence. Now, let's go back in time and talk about how that happened, because it's really a very interesting story. The first bullet item is just meant to be a reference to the fact that, you know, in the 19th century, black slavery was they would justify black slavery by saying, look, you know, these are the descendants of Cain, they deserve what they get, it's their own fault. Joseph Smith was actually, I mean, in my opinion, was really kind of ahead of his time in the sense that he did ordain black people the priesthood. Black people joined his church. He gave them the priesthood. Didn't really think about it much. In 1844, believe it or not, he ran for president of the United States. And in his presidential platform, he's got a little paragraph in there that says, I would like to propose that we sell public land, use the proceeds from the sale of that public land to basically buy the freedom of all the slaves in the United States and let them all go. Okay? And, you know, this is, admittedly, I mean, he was a northerner, he had abolitionist sympathies and stuff, but, you know, if you realize just how racist America was in the 19th century, this really was kind of a progressive idea. But Joseph Smith died before he could really take that idea to fruition. And when Brigham Young took over, Brigham Young had no such progressive ideas. In Brigham Young's worldview, blacks are the servant of servants and the descendants of Cain, and that's the way things are, and they're just simply not allowed to hold the priesthood whatsoever. He was asked on one occasion, is this because of their behavior in the pre-existence? And he flat out said no. The pre-mortal existence. Mormons tend to call it the pre-existence as a shorthand, but it's the pre-mortal existence. He was asked, is that why it is? And Brigham Young said no. Brigham Young specifically said, the priesthood is withheld from them, not because of anything they did in the past, but because they are the descendants of Cain and God doesn't want them to hold the priesthood. And that's really all he said. So years go by, and people are trying to figure out why blacks can't hold the priesthood, and, you know, people become a little more enlightened over time, and they kind of think, well, gee, what could it have been? Maybe, you know, the only thing that I can think of is that maybe they were, I don't know, doing something in the pre-existence that warranted this. I mean, I can't think of any other reason why that could be. And it kind of seemed like a logical explanation. And a little more time went by, and suddenly it kind of became the only explanation we can think of. A little more time went by, and suddenly it became the explanation. This is what happened. It became, by 1941, it became, and there was a statement that was read, a statement that came out from the president of the church saying, this is what the reason is, we're really sorry, we can't do anything about it, but this is what God wants, and this is why. You see what I mean? So this sort of thing sort of evolved from maybe this is why, you know, evolved from we can't figure out why to maybe this is why to this is probably why to this is why, right? In the 1970s, you know, civil rights movement's going strong, and the Mormons are just digging in their heels saying, no, we're simply not going to give blacks a priesthood. We can't. God doesn't want us to do that. And the church was getting, you know, basically kicked in the butt again. You know, we're going to confiscate your property, and we're not going to play football with your BYU football team and stuff like that. We're going to boycott you unless you come around. In 1978, the prophet, the president of the church at that time, whose name was Spencer W. Kimball, issued a pronouncement. This time he did get all the other apostles to buy into it, which is surprising because his successor in the presidency was extremely racist, was a John Birch Society member, and was known for saying things like, the civil rights movement is not their fault. The blacks are not to blame for the civil rights movement. They're being persuaded, they're being led astray by communist sympathizers, stuff like that. I mean, he was just nuts. Spencer W. Kimball got all the apostles to buy in on the idea that it's finally time to lift the ban, and issued a statement that said, short question?
Yes, is any of the Mormon communities,
I think particularly in Missouri, were any of them ever slaveholders? It's kind of difficult to say. Most Mormons came from northern states and from Europe. There weren't a lot of them, but I mean, yeah, the Mormons were recruiting, you know, proselytes from all over. I'm sure there were some, but I also know that Joseph Smith sent out instructions to the missionaries when they went off to the southern states not to baptize slaves without their holder's permission. So I mean, yeah, there was some of that, but Mormons by and large were not slaveholders, but. Which was a slave state, yeah. Now, there's many reasons why they got kicked out of Missouri, and one of those was the Mormons represented a big influx of voters who were, you know, not into slaveholding, and those who were already there kind of went, wait, you know, we don't want you guys swaying the vote here. We like our votes the way they are. That's one of the reasons they got kicked out. Question?
Who were the early Mormon immigrants who, San Bernardino County carried slaves along with them?
Really? Really? I didn't know that. Okay. Okay, back to this. Yeah, so Spencer W. Kimball publishes a statement that says, the time has fully come which was prophesied by the prophets of old that I should just read it instead of trying to quote it from memory, but the time has come which was prophesied by the prophets of old when all of God's children would be able to hold the priesthood. We have no idea what the hell he was talking about because prophets never said that. But it's in writing. I mean, you said something in there about how the time has arrived. Prophets said that. I remember asking one time. Okay, so I'm 14 years old in 1978, right? Now you know how old I am. And this thing got announced in church, and I listened to this and I went, what just happened? Because it doesn't actually say blacks can hold the priesthood now. It just says every worthy male member can hold the priesthood. And I went to my parents and I said, what does that mean? And they said, well, it means that everybody can hold a priesthood now. And I said, well, they could anyway. And that's when my parents sat me down and said, there's a little bit we didn't tell you. Years later, summer of 2001, I sat down with my parents. And I said, Dad, how could you not tell me this? 14 years of my life. And I suddenly find this out when, you know, what? And my dad, and I can kind of understand my dad's point of view. He said, are you really going to hold it against me that we didn't tell you those things about the church that we didn't support, that we didn't believe in? I kind of see that because, right, when I'm dating somebody, I don't tell them right away that I'm an ex-Mormon. It's just not something that I want people to know. I can kind of see my parents' point of view, but I looked at him and I said, Dad, yes, how else am I going to evaluate whether I want to belong to this church if I don't know the whole story? So the interesting thing is the ban was lifted in 1978, which now allows every worthy male member of the church to hold a priesthood, which interestingly enough allows black men to go into the temple, because they couldn't go into the temple before 1978 either. But what's interesting is that whole evolutionary rationale for why the ban was in place in the first place has never been rescinded. They have never come out and said, oh, we were wrong about that. Now, they very easily could, because never at any time was there any kind of revelation that said, this is why blacks can't hold a priesthood. But the problem is that if they ever come out and say, you know, we were wrong the whole time, their whole right of precedence, you know, their whole ability to say, God is leading this church, falls apart. And so they're in a real bind when it comes to trying to say, yeah, we had this ban, but we didn't really mean it. And God wasn't really responsible for it, and we're really sorry, because if God wasn't responsible for it, how did it ever happen in the first place? There, I'm actually not really clear on that, but yeah, there was. See, the thing is, I was 14, right? No, it's a really good question. I was 14. I've never actually gotten that detail. I know that there were some disputes, you know, and they had something to do with playing football with BYU and something about property rights and stuff. And but yeah, I mean, the federal government was, you know, closing in on them and saying, look, you can't keep doing this. I think what it really had to do was with their tax-exempt status. I think they finally decided,
yeah.
My tax-exempt status is going to be at risk here, and I've really got to change.
I remember the article, and I remember the headline on the article, and it was just before, it was like 2 days before it was going to court, and they were obviously going to lose. And the headline said, Mormon leader has revelation.
Yeah. It's interesting though, if you actually read the document, it's not phrased as a, you know, it doesn't say thus saith the Lord, you know, it's none of that. It's just, it's really just a press announcement. To whom it actually starts out, to whom it may concern. It's not, you know what I mean? I mean, I can let you read the document. I mean, in the 1800s when prophets got revelation, it was, you know, thus saith the Lord God Almighty from on high, and this is how things are going to be. In 1978, it was just a press release, and that's all we have.
What about
women? What?
Okay.
That brings me to the next slide. This is women in the priesthood. I can't believe you guys are still hanging on. What? Okay. There was some speculation that blacks were the descendants of Ham, whites were the descendants of
Shem,
and the Asians were the descendants of Japheth. Yeah. That's never been canonized, though. That was just kind of speculation. The only two things that I can comment on are this bit about blacks in the priesthood and how blacks are the descendants of Cain, because that is canonized. And the other comment is Native Americans with, you know, their dark reddish skin. The Book of Mormon is extremely clear, unambiguously, there's some details we can talk about, but it's unambiguously clear that these were originally white Israelites who came to this continent, split off into two groups, the righteous group and the bad group, and the bad group was cursed with a dark skin. This bad group with the dark skin basically wiped out the good guys in 400 A.D., leaving Mormon and his son Moroni to bury the record so they could be found 1,400 years later. So dark skin in Mormonism is a curse. I mean, it's a curse because Cain was cursed with it, the Lamanites were cursed with it, but the whole Asian, you know, it's not talked about. It's simply not talked about. There's some speculation that that's Japheth, but Mormonism doesn't really ask that question or answer it either. Everybody's welcome. Everybody's welcome to hold the priesthood now. Prior to 1978. Yes. And yes. And the black skin thing is an interesting one too, because up until about 1960, if you had black skin, that was it. You're out. You can't hold the priesthood. If you did your family history research and found that any of your ancestors had black skin, you were out. Which was an interesting. You basically, that was a very good disincentive for keeping people, you know, disincentive for doing your family history. So in the 1960s, there was a little modification that said, okay, you can have black skin if that black skin comes from anywhere other than Africa. Like if you're black from, like, Brazil, then it's okay. Anyway. So anyway, then there's this bit with women, right? Women, the reorganized LDS Church in Missouri has granted women the priesthood since about 1982, I think, or maybe 4. But Mormon women do not hold the priesthood and never have. But Joseph Smith, again, Joseph Smith was kind of a progressive kind of guy, and he was at least giving some thought to turning the whole women's organization into another branch. Remember the Aaronic priesthood and the Melchizedek priesthood? Who's going to do another, you know, branch of the priesthood with the women? So that they were going to be kind of an equally governing body of, you know, their own. But he died before he could bring that to, you know, make that, bring that to pass. But that's also something your Mormon friends and relatives don't know this, right? This is there's an interesting book called Women and Authority, written by a friend of mine named Maxine Hanks, who was excommunicated for publishing the book, in which she highlights some of this evidence. And it's really very fascinating if you're into Mormon history at all. But you know, except for that little, you know, hiccup, Mormon women have never had the priesthood. Now, why not?
I mean,
oh, thank you. Question is, why not? And Mormons don't have an answer for this. I mean, they really don't. I mean, if you read the Book of Mormon is all male. There's you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of men in the Book of Mormon, and like three women, two of whom have a name. The origins of Mormonism were really very male-oriented. Women were really just kind of there to be mothers and polygamous wives, and you know, men were kind of what was really mattered. And over time, people who have asked the question, why don't women have the priesthood? Why, you know, in other words, having the priesthood gives you the authority to baptize and give blessings and healings. And, you know, why can't women do that? What's the big deal? Mormons don't know. I mean, it's another one of these things where it's been this way all this time. Nobody's really thought to question it, and they're not being taken to court over it, so why change it? Mormons themselves have let... There's been kind of this evolution... What? Who's laughing and why?
You're a bit cynical, I think.
Okay.
You like me that way.
So Mormons have kind of, in an attempt to kind of be, I don't know, gracious and benevolent, have kind of said, well, it's because... It's the same kind of thing, right? It's this idea where we can only come up with one possible speculation that might make sense, and it kind of evolves over time into the reason, right? And in this case, the reason is that women are innately spiritual.
We have 5 minutes. I have a program here
at
3 hours.
Oh, do you? Oh, okay, we're going to have to take it somewhere else. Okay. Yeah, I'm really sorry about this, too. This has just sort of been going on. Anyway, the idea is that women are innately more spiritual than men, that men need to hold the priesthood because it's what keeps them from being savages, and it's what keeps them from being, you know, evil and you know, just wicked.
A bullet will do the same thing.
What?
A bullet will do the same thing. It will keep them from being savage.
True, yeah. So what's interesting is that over time, the argument exists, the line of thought exists within Mormonism that men are to priesthood what women are to motherhood, that motherhood is what gives women the ability to be caring and nurturing. And those of us who don't buy into that argument are kind of scratching our heads going, wait, I thought the equivalent to motherhood was fatherhood. In which case, you know, fatherhood should be teaching men the same thing that motherhood is teaching women, and priesthood should be applied to everybody equally, but there's simply no, you know, I mean, that has, the folk doctrine has not evolved in that way within Mormonism. So right now, if you ask a Mormon why women don't hold the priesthood, it's because you'll get told something like, well, she doesn't need it, it's not something that, you know, she really needs to know. Oh, yeah.
Who knows what it's going to be 100 years
from now? Oh, it's absolutely. It's changing all the time. Don't get me started or I'll never get out of here. Mormonism likes to claim that it's the fastest growing religion, and in fact, if you look at their press releases, they say that on every single press release they issue. The facts, the numerical facts, say something very different, which is that they're simply not growing at the same rate that they used to be. And my personal belief is that the internet has a lot to do with that. They are growing, but they're not the fastest growing religion in the country. There are lots of religions that grow a lot faster than they do. What was your question? Oh, whether it's eroding. I have an old presentation by a guy that I'm getting off track. Who makes the point that Mormonism used to be very peculiar and very enclosed and very you know, self-contained. We are a peculiar people. We are our own sort of, you know, enclave. God is going to come back to Earth in our midst, and we're going to, you know, rule the planet. Over time, they're really trying hard to be more and more ecumenical. They're trying more and more to get people to see them as another Christian church. In fact, 10 years ago, they took the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints used to be in all the same letters, and about 10 years ago, they made Jesus Christ really big. And their logo now says the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. They really want people to see them as just another Christian church. They're trying to be more ecumenical. But what happens is every time they do that, they lose sort of their peculiarity and the selling points, kind of, they lose more and more of the selling points that make them marketable. And yeah, it's diluting, and after a while you're going to have kind of a Mormon church that really is just like every other Christian church. And then people are going to be going, well, why should I join you then? What's the point? Yeah, sure, yeah. Yeah, I think we're done. Thank you all. I'm available for conversing with after this. We can go somewhere else.
Buy you a beer.
Alcoholic.